You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week David Rothauser. He is a peace activist. He is a playwright of anti-war plays. He has taught a course at Newberry College in Massachusetts on war and peace and America in Vietnam. He has a number of plays, and he has a brand new film that we are going to be talking about that I found extremely valuable. It's called Article 9 Comes to America, and it was featured recently at the United Nations Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference. David Rothauser, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I appreciate being here.
It's great to have you on. I very much enjoyed the film, historical lessons that I don't think are taught in many history classes in the United States. Let's just start with the basics. What is Article 9?
Well, Article 9 was actually the brainchild of Baron Kijiro Shidehara, who was a peace activist in Japan during the 1920s and 30s, even during the Japanese invasion and occupation of China. And he remained a peace activist all during World War II and became prime minister in 1945. He made a proposal to General Douglas MacArthur to write a peace constitution for Japan. And this was along the same lines of the thinking of General MacArthur at the time. He was MacArthur himself felt that war in the 20th century had become obsolete with the invention and use of the atomic bomb. So he was wide open to this suggestion from Shidehara.
So this was in 1947 that the United
States... Well, it was finalized in 1947, but the process began in 1945.
I'm struck by the language of Article 9 in the Japanese Constitution because I wrote a book about a treaty called the Kellogg-Briand Pact from 1928, which is very much a very, very similar language. And in your film, in fact, one of the people credits, rightly or wrongly, the U.S. peace movement for some role here, which seems like you never know where you might succeed or through whom. I mean, through an occupying army of the United States imposing opposition to war on a surrendered nation. I doubt that was what any U.S. peace activists in the 1920s had in mind.
It was actually a collaboration between Shidehara and other progressive people in the Japanese government with MacArthur to make this happen, but ultimately and really interestingly enough, it was really the Japanese people, the citizens, who supported this whole thing wholeheartedly, and even offered their suggestions on how it should be developed. It was amazing the role they played.
And now Japan, which had previously gone centuries without war before the opening up by the West and this sort of training as a junior partner in imperialism that backfired, now has gone another 70 years without making war, right?
Yes, it has. And what I find really interesting about that is that until now, many people, popular misconception is that this was a United States occupation law imposed upon Japan, but in fact it was a collaboration. But even more importantly, it's been recently interpreted as a form of apology that is in action, which means the document is more than something written on paper. It's something that the people practice on a daily basis in Japan and have practiced for 70 years. And so it could be interpreted as a form of apology. Japan, of course, does not make official apologies very deeply or sincerely, apparently.
And adhered to, if I'm not mistaken, if not absolutely perfectly, more strictly than in the case of Germany, which has a similar history and a similar culture of peace since World War II.
Yes, that's correct. Germany has a very similar constitution. However, they do permit the use of combat troops in international situations where the Japanese Article 9 does not permit that at all.
David Rothauser, you sent me this timeline of the history of Article 9 up to the present, which is very useful, and it wasn't long. By 1950, you know, 3 years after the finalization of this, that the United States government was saying, never mind, we didn't mean it.
That's right. And they approached Japan, and they said, look, we'd like you to drop Article 9. Prior to that, Senator Nixon had said publicly that, and in Tokyo, he'd said publicly that the Japanese Constitution was a mistake, and that by 1950, the U.S. tried to get Japan to drop Article 9 and rearm and go to war with us against North Korea.
And the Japanese people and the Japanese government said no, and you have a very interesting quote from Prime Minister Shiguru at this point. What did he say was decisive here?
Yeah, a couple of things he said was, he said no, he says, we're not going to war. He said, you gave Japanese women the right to vote. They won't let us go to war. And he was very strong about that, which I think it was a turning point where people could argue that, oh, well, this is an American-imposed constitution. But at that point, when Japan refused to rearm, they took sole responsibility for maintaining Article 9 in their own constitution.
Yeah, it couldn't be imposed on them when the imposing power was demanding they retract it, and they said, no, we like it, we're keeping it.
That's right.
What happened next in the 1950s? You mentioned something called the three non-nuclear principles.
These principles were agreed upon among the Japanese that they would forbid their own nation to possess, manufacture, or allow nuclear weapons to be introduced into its territory, into Japanese territory. By 1959, the U.S. and Japan governments formed a secret pact to bring nuclear weapons to Japanese harbors, and it was a direct violation of the three non-nuclear principles. But because it was secret, no one knew about it for quite a while.
And what happened when they found out?
I think there were demonstrations against it in Japan. It didn't reach a crescendo until the late 60s, but that was by then. Those demonstrations were in opposition to the Japanese involvement in the Vietnam War.
Japan has had some troubles with nuclear energy. What about nuclear weapons in Japan now?
That's an interesting question. And this is my way of thinking about it. I may be wrong, but Prime Minister Abe wants to bring Japan to the level of a normal player on the world stage, which means he's trying to rebuild the Japanese military so they can play a role alongside the United States and in defending the U.S. or any other ally in case of a military confrontation. If he is successful in dropping Article 9 and becoming a world player and a normal player on the world stage, he has to compete with the other major industrial normal players on the world stage who are all proponents of nuclear weapons and all have nuclear weapons, many of them ready to launch. If he then is able to compete or wants to compete with those nations, he must develop nuclear weapons, in my way of thinking. That is going to be a tough order, but that's what he's faced with.
We're speaking with David Rothauser, whose film is called Article 9, Comes to America. I know some in the Japanese government have been on record saying that that Japan favors nuclear energy because it leaves them so close to having a nuclear weapon, and everyone knows it. But before we come to the present, let's follow the timeline the rest of the way up. What happened when the U.S. went to war in Vietnam and wanted Japan on its side?
Well, yeah, they were nudging Japan along the way all along from 1950 to drop the peace constitution. And in Vietnam, the Japanese government did agree to provide U.S. bases on the mainland in Japan and on Okinawa. And that kicked off huge demonstrations by Japanese citizens who marched against these actions. In American actions in Indochina in the late 60s. And they formed the biggest anti-war movement in their history at that time. Japanese people themselves held firm to Article 9, but they the government was giving way little by little.
But the United States, in cahoots with the Japanese government, got some secret assistance of some kind and got bases that are still there and expanding. And we didn't mention in the 50s, Japan had already developed a big police force, home defense police force, instead of a military. So it seems it's eroding a little bit. These baby steps are being taken in the direction of militarism.
Yes, exactly. That started in the early 50s when Japan settled for a 75,000 home defense police force. I guess one could argue and say, well, they need to protect themselves on their homeland. That's why they got away with that.
Well, some of us argue there are better defenses than violence, and the wisdom in the Japanese Constitution embodies that. But next came the Gulf War, and another little step by the Japanese.
Yes, they at that point, the first Gulf War, 1990. There was Japanese military participation in the Gulf War, but they not in a combat situation, and the Japanese people held on to their constitution, but there was supportive military Japanese military in the first Gulf War.
It's always been a point of contention among resistors to war. Is it acceptable to support a war if you're not in a combat role and so forth? I mean, what did the Japanese public think of that? Did they see this as a step toward violating their peace constitution, or it was acceptable and not a big deal?
From what I've learned is that yes, they resisted participating in it, but the relationship between the Japanese government and the people is very it's hard to explain. Japanese people, by and large, are fairly passive, but they when they are aroused about their own constitution, it's something that they cling to, and they do not give up. So they held firmly to their constitution and would not permit combat troops to go to the Gulf War.
And then came the so-called global war on terror, starting with the U.S. war on U.S. and partners war on Afghanistan that has yet to end. And then what step did Japan take?
Yeah, well, at that point, Prime Minister Koizumi pledged support to the U.S. He said, we are an ally of the United States, and we should live up to that agreement. And he pledged support. And he made a statement that to the Japanese people, he said, by doing this, he said, I want to condition the Japanese people that someday Japan may have to go to war.
He said that publicly. I'm conditioning you to prepare you to accept war.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Wow. And what did they actually contribute thus far to the war in Afghanistan?
They supported NATO forces, limiting their support to refueling NATO ships basically in the Indian Ocean.
So rather a token gesture in terms
yes.
of enlarging the names on the coalition of the willing, I would think.
Yes.
And then Iraq.
Then in the 2003 Iraq War, Japan served as a repair facility for U.S. aircraft, ships, tanks, and artillery. So on the mainland and on Okinawa, they had repair facilities for damaged ships, aircraft, and so forth.
Now, if you could take a ship or an aircraft from Iraq to Japan and have it worked on and bring it back to Iraq, first of all, how damaged was it to begin with? Second of all, is it worth the fuel? Third of all, how helpful was that really? I mean, was this, again, a desire to get Japan's name on a list of countries in a coalition, or was this actually a service to the war effort?
Your questions are very, very pertinent because it raises the question just how damaged were these ships, aircraft, tanks, and artillery, especially fighting against an enemy that was, virtually non-existent. So not too much damage could have happened. I'm not sure what else went on behind the scenes in that agreement with Japan.
Well, it all seems like token gestures and minor plays that nonetheless may have been meant to serve and may have served that openly expressed desire to condition the Japanese people for what was coming next, because now we have Prime Minister Abe, who has recently been to speak to Congress, and Americans got a taste of who he is. What's his position, and what's he trying to do?
Well, Prime Minister Abe has openly stated that he wants to reestablish a pride in Japan, similar to what they had before World War II, where they had a military they could be proud of in the samurai tradition, and they could feel good about themselves, they could protect themselves. But by the same token, he did not want to give up his alliance with the United States. So he did not say publicly that they would break their security pact with the U.S. and take on full responsibility for their own security. But by building up the military, he is obviously wants to be in an ally with the United States in whatever imperialistic ventures or perhaps military operations the United States might envision for their future in Asia. And this is fairly clear, but not always spoken in public.
Abe seems to have outdone John Yoo and Jay Bybee and every lawyer who's ever worked at the Office of Legal Counsel in Washington in terms of his powers of reinterpretation, because at least according to news reports, he's reinterpreting the crystal clear, simple language of Article 9, which forbids war entirely, he's reinterpreting it to mean that Japan can run around the world participating in wars. How is that possible?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, how that is possible. He's getting away with it because he has the full support of his Liberal Democratic Party in the Diet. And so he can pretty much do what he wants within that framework. And reinterpretation of the Constitution is one thing he has been able to force. And it's only been recently that the Japanese people have arisen in public to go out and massively demonstrate against his pushing these new they're almost laws. They're not law yet, but pushing these new laws into the government. But he is able to get away with it. I think partly because he has been very successful in restoring the Japanese economy to a certain level, and people were supportive of him at that point.
Right,
but that's
so
breaking down now.
But his reinterpretation of existing law isn't a done deal, right? He wants to actually pass a law through the legislature that says the Constitution is hereby reinterpreted to mean black is white,
and that's exactly
where the struggle is now focused. Right? This may come to a vote relatively soon.
Yes. It was voted on in the lower house of parliament, and they agreed to it. They passed it. It's now going to the upper house that will vote in later on in this month. And if they vote against it, it goes back to the lower house, and Abe has full support of the lower house, and they can automatically pass it into law. But that's already being challenged by constitutional lawyers from different academic universities as unconstitutional, and they're protesting that, working on that.
So there's a legal challenge. There's also a popular challenge, right? I mean, the polls suggest, and the mass movement suggests, and as you noted on your timeline, there's the organizations pushing for maintaining Article 9 have been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, there seems to be a good deal of public opposition to what Abe is trying to do.
Yes, there is. Part of it comes from a housewife, a little housewife, Naomi Takasu, who organized, she raised something like 27 or 24,000 signatures, which she submitted to the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to have Article 9 as a Nobel Prize, to be nominated for the Nobel Prize. And it was nominated but defeated. But she's working on it again for this year, 2015. And in addition to that, there's been a youth movement that was until recently unseen in Japan. Young people, by and large, knew very, very little about World War II or Article 9 or any of these events. But now they're awakening, and there's one organization called SEALDS, SEALDS, Students Emergency Action for Liberal Democracy, has taken the bit, and they're challenging the Abe administration with massive demonstrations in Tokyo and throughout Japan.
Yeah, I had a guest on this program some months back who had written a book called The Imperial Cruise about how the United States, back in the days of Teddy Roosevelt and earlier, had sought to train up Japan as a militarist force, as an arm of U.S. imperialism in Asia, that then had gotten out of control like a Frankenstein monster and wanted to be its own imperial force, thank you very much, with blowback hitting Pearl Harbor and elsewhere. I mean, what makes the U.S. government think that things are any different now if it's going to arm and militarize Japan with a U.S. blessing? What makes it think that a Japanese military would remain loyal to the Pentagon?
Well, I think they've got the backing of Prime Minister Abe, and they've got the security pact, which has been in place for many, many years. And Japan doesn't want to go it alone, and they pretty much take their orders from the United States, and they're happy with that. The government is happy with that. It's I make a distinction between the government and the people.
So you think that would never change, no matter how big a military Japan builds?
That agreement will never change, you say?
The Japanese happiness with a sort of subservient role to the United States.
Oh, it doesn't appear that it will change. No, it's a very strong alliance, and there's no indication that will change unless the people are successful in their move to retain Article 9 and forbid Japan from this militaristic alliance with the United States.
What should Americans and others outside of Japan be doing to help? What should we be demanding of our governments, or how should we be contributing to the effort to maintain Article 9 and to support Japan as a leader against militarism, when all of our other governments are parties to the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which requires the same ban on war? Just nobody knows it.
Well, that's the answer right there. Most Americans don't know anything about Article 9, or very little about the Japanese peace constitution. They know that Japan is a pacifist nation, and that's about it. I think what we can do is to help educate the American people, to alert them to the fact that our military ventures over the past 20, 30-some years lead nowhere, and they lead to nothing but destruction, and they're counterproductive. And if we can little by little plant seeds, then in hopes that it will bear some fruit, then, you know, that's what we must continue to do on a daily basis. I think if we set an example in that way, such as Article 9 is an example for the Japanese people, if we can set an example in our own country, then I think that's a possibility. I think one final thing is that if Japan and the United States are able to overcome these militaristic tendencies and collaborate with Article 9 in both nations, they can form an international coalition to support the United Nations mandate that was set in 1945 to abolish war making.
David Rothauser's film is Article 9 Comes to America. See it, support it. David, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David, for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, people around the world have been riveted by heartbreaking images of refugees fleeing Syria, as well as heartening ones of European citizens offering help in hospice. But if the pictures drive you to want to know more, don't expect much help from U.S. media, who are not that interested to get at the roots of the situation. We'll talk about the Syrian refugee crisis with Riad Jarrar from the American Friends Service Committee. Also on the show, internet activists fighting for net neutrality declared victory in February when the FCC ruled to consider broadband a public utility. So why are we now seeing op-eds declaring net neutrality in jeopardy? It seems confusing, and maybe that's the idea. We'll find out what's going on from Tim Carr of the group Free Press. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. Report: more than half of immigrants on welfare, declared the headline on a September 2nd story in USA Today. Reporter Alan Gomez claims research shows that some 51% of immigrant-led households receive public assistance, compared to 30% of what he calls native-led households. If that makes you suspicious, it should. The study, it turns out, is from the Center for Immigration Studies, described by USA Today as advocating for lower levels of immigration, which is true. Also true is that it was founded by infamous white nationalist John Tanton, who openly questioned whether minorities could participate in advanced society and maintains ties to white supremacists and Holocaust deniers. If you suspect that might make their research questionable, write again. This study, for instance, takes as its unit of study immigrant-led households, which often include spouses or children who are native-born or naturalized citizens. In other words, much of the assistance is going to U.S. citizens. As Ben Norton wrote for FAIR, that sleight of hand was noted by the Cato Institute, not exactly a bastion of liberalism. Cato also notes that when poor immigrants do use welfare, they consume a lower dollar value than poor U.S. citizens. That's likely why the researchers don't compare the costs of welfare going to immigrant-led households with that going to citizens, or acknowledge that immigrants on welfare pay 45 times more in taxes than they receive in benefits. That might discourage folks like CNBC from headlining their write-ups, "Are immigrants really freeloaders? New study backs Trump's attacks." Well, the Center for Immigration Studies has its own reasons for churning out misinformation. But as Norton notes, part of the reason this sort of stuff can get in the paper is that it echoes a more widely held myth that people receive public assistance because they don't work. In reality, as an article earlier this year pointed out, it's poor-paying jobs, not unemployment, that push many people to rely on aid. In some industries, about half the workforce relies on public assistance, including 52% of fast food workers. That story came from the hippies at the Wall Street Journal. Cable giant Comcast is widely reckoned the most hated company in the country, but they have at least one friend. Media startup Vox ran an explainer September 8th, telling readers that Comcast's policy of bundling cable, making you buy channels you don't want in order to get the ones you do, is really in consumers' best interest, even if consumers don't know it. Bundling almost certainly saves customers money in aggregate, the piece said, because as a behemoth, Comcast can negotiate better deals. Or, as a photo caption put it, quote, "Comcast may not be much loved by its customers, but it has the weight of their collective voice in its bargaining over carriage fees," close quote. Well, it is weird to read about how Comcast looks out for the little guy, but it gets less weird when you realize, as was pointed out by Gawker, that Comcast not only seeded Vox's initial run, they recently gave another $200 million to parent company Vox Media, Inc. And no, Vox did not disclose that relationship until they were social media shamed into it, at which point they added a footnote in microscopic print. Which just goes to show that media can be new and still operate in, sadly, familiar ways. And finally, the New York Times ran an article September 3rd about the use of cluster bombs, which reporter Rick Gladstone aptly described as the widely outlawed munitions that kill and maim indiscriminately in conflicts in Libya, Sudan, Syria, Ukraine, and Yemen. Five countries that have not signed the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which banned the production, sale, and use of these weapons in 2010. Wrote Gladstone, quote, "The use of these weapons was criticized by all 117 countries that have joined the treaty, which took effect 5 years ago. Their use was also criticized by a number of others, including the United States, that have not yet joined the treaty but have abided by its provisions." Close quote. That's just flat wrong. The convention not only bans the use of cluster bombs, which the U.S. military used against Serbia, Afghanistan, and Iraq before the treaty went into effect, but did not use subsequently in its air attacks on Libya. It also mandates that signatories are, quote, "never under any circumstances to develop, produce, otherwise acquire, stockpile, retain, or transfer to anyone, directly or indirectly, cluster munitions," close quote. As Human Rights Watch reported, quote, "credible evidence indicates that the Saudi-led coalition used banned cluster munitions supplied by the United States in airstrikes against Houthi forces in Yemen," close quote. That's this year. Even were the Saudis or the United Arab Emirates not using the cluster bombs, the U.S. simply making and transferring them and stockpiling them in its own arsenal clearly violates the convention. Their use by the U.S.'s allies presumably puts Washington in conflict with another provision forbidding parties to assist others in activities contrary to the treaty. Fair pointed this out in an action alert, which noted that, aside from the falsehood, the Times failed to follow the principles of newsworthiness, which, for a paper with a largely American audience, would make the U.S.'s manufacture and sale of the weapons being described a central point. Not long after our alert went out, the Times ran a correction, noting that the U.S. is not, in fact, among the countries that abide by the treaty's provisions. More importantly, the story was rewritten to include the fact that U.S.-made cluster bombs continue to be used in the Yemen conflict. Fair appreciates that correction and expanded reporting, and thanks everyone who communicated with the Times. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. A recent CNN report said that the worsening Syrian refugee crisis highlights the differences among countries that welcome what they called desperate migrants and those that don't. But if U.S. audiences think that the crisis, some 11 million people now displaced, reflects only on the action or inaction of countries over there, they're misunderstanding the situation. What more do we need to know about this crisis, its roots, and possible ways forward? Raya Jarar is government relations manager at the American Friends Service Committee. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Raya Jarar.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, when we spoke to you about this time last year, it was in the context of demands from media talking heads and politicians that the U.S. must do something in Syria and Iraq. At that time, it was do something to wipe out ISIS. Now we hear again that the U.S. must do something in Syria, but it's not clear from coverage that we're even really talking about the same place. I don't want you to oversimplify, but there is a connection directly between that do something and this do something, is there not?
Definitely. I think that is one of the main issues that's happening now, the lack of connection between the humanitarian crisis of all of the refugees and displaced people in the Middle East and the U.S. own actions in that part of the world. U.S. mainstream media and mainstream politicians have been trying to deal with the humanitarian crisis as if it just happened because of a natural disaster, as if there is a tsunami that have hit the Middle East, and that's why we're having millions of displaced people. That is not the case. These people who are leaving their homes in Iraq and Syria and Libya and Afghanistan and elsewhere and going to Europe, they are going there because of political and military unrest in their homes. And the fact of the matter is that Europe and the United States played an instrumental role in destroying most of these countries and creating the conditions where people had to leave their countries in the first place. So while humanitarian assistance is important, and I agree with the calls for Europe and the U.S. to do something, I think that something should include some humanitarian assistance and helping refugees, but it also has to include looking at the larger picture and understanding that the actual solution for the refugee crisis is a political solution that would solve the situation back at home and allow for voluntary repatriation.
Well, we have talked about a kind of amnesia, if you will, that we're always hearing pundits talk about the U.S. should start intervening in Syria. You know, Slate had a piece yesterday saying Hillary Clinton was pushing action in Syria, which Obama rejected. The idea is that it's explicit. You know, we need to start intervening and stop being on the sidelines. What, in fact, has the U.S. been doing in Syria, for example?
I mean, our foreign policy engagement at large is very militarized. There was a really amazing report that came out later last year by the Congressional Research Service, CRS, and the report looked into the U.S. spending on wars since 9/11. So it found out that, you know, we've spent trillions of dollars on wars. Surprise, everyone knows that at this stage. But the thing that I found extremely interesting in the report is that 93% of the spending went to the Department of Defense, and 7% went to the State Department and USAID. And I think that is an actual reflection of the U.S. foreign policy. It's a policy based on militarism and almost exclusively uses military tools. So now when we deal with crises like the one happening in the Middle East, it doesn't seem like we have other tools in the toolbox other than sending a bomb. We have to bomb someone. You know, there are refugees running away. You know, we have to bomb someone. And it's such a frustrating knee-jerk reaction to think about a solution to this crisis by using the same tools that had started the crisis in the first place. Military intervention in the Middle East have started this crisis in the first place. So definitely no. No to more intervention in Syria or in Iraq. The U.S. has responsibilities because it broke many of these countries, but these responsibilities cannot be fulfilled through military action. They can be fulfilled through political and economic and other source of engagement in the region that would end the military conflict and put all of these countries on the path of stabilization.
Well, just to be clear that in Syria, the U.S. has dropped bombs, this idea that Syria has been spared military intervention and perhaps we should try using it is simply false historically. You know,
of course. Yeah. And the U.S. has been involved in Syria in so many different ways. There is direct military intervention by dropping bombs. There are even some special operations where U.S. troops have been sent to Syria that we know of now. There is also the indirect intervention by training and equipping different parts of the conflict in Syria and Iraq. Keep in mind that the conflicts in Syria and Iraq at this stage are linked, and the U.S. is funding and training different parts of this conflict at different sides of the border. So even the U.S. involvement in Iraq at this stage is, in a way, contributing to the situation in Syria as well. The U.S. is very, very heavily involved militarily in Iraq and Syria and the rest of the Middle East, and claiming that what's going on now is happening because of the lack of U.S. military intervention is laughable. I mean, it's a joke. We have wasted literally trillions of dollars destroying the Middle East so far. And I think that is the thing that the Middle East needs the least at this stage. People need less bombs, and they need less interventions, and I think they need more of political and economic solutions that are on the table. Many people in the region, in Iraq and in Syria, are discussing ideas for moving forward. The U.S. and other international and regional powers can play a positive role in creating a space for these local initiatives to start moving forward. So not necessarily participating in them, but at least helping to stop the intervention in these countries.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about ways forward in a second. I just want to underscore, in terms of the gap between the media reality and the reality, to the extent that I have just heard recently the idea that the U.S. might be in any way implicated in the situation in Syria. It's been quoting remarks to that effect from Turkish President Erdogan and from Vladimir Putin, you know, which when the U.S. media quote them saying something, it's almost a code for saying it's crazy talk, you know. So that is the how marginalized the idea of considering the U.S. role in creating this problem is within the mainstream media. But I want to come back finally to talk about going forward, because like it or not, people have been riveted by these images. You know, we all know that there are many humanitarian crises going on at the moment, but for whatever reasons, this one has captured people's attention. So when people are thinking about what they can do or what they can push their governments to do, what are the things that we can suggest as ways forward? You've started already to talk about it.
I mean, I think UNHCR has a good framework in dealing with displaced people at large in general. What we're seeing in Europe is a drop in the ocean. You know, it grabbed media attention. But the entire number of people who went to Europe this year is a few hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants. It actually adds up to less than 1% of the population in Europe. Less than 1%, it's 0.06% of the population of Europe. So it's not really a human wave that is taking over Europe. Look at what's going on in Beirut, in Lebanon, for example. Almost 25 or 30% of the population at this stage are refugees. We're talking about numbers that are staggering. You know, 20, 30, 40% of the populations of neighboring countries are refugees. The size of the problem is definitely exaggerated in Europe, but that doesn't mean that it's not a real problem. And it has an immediate response that starts with humanitarian aid and allowing refugees to resettle to third countries, like what they're doing now in Europe. But that is just the tip of the iceberg. The actual solution to displaced people, as I mentioned earlier, is fixing the root causes that caused their displacement, and that will allow for voluntary repatriation. And between that and the settlement to third countries, UNHCR suggests reaching out to displaced communities where they are now and helping them integrate. So the ones who are in Syria, who moved to Turkey or Lebanon, or displaced inside Syria still, or moved to other countries, how can we reach out to them in camps or in urban areas to ease their suffering and help them integrate in the communities, have their kids go to schools, etc.? Humanitarian aid and allowing some thousands to come to the U.S. or Europe is definitely needed, but that is only the tip of the iceberg. And without dealing with the crisis as a whole, I don't think we will get to an actual solution.
We've been speaking with Rai Jarar of the American Friends Service Committee. You can find their work online at afsc.org. Thank you very much, Rai Jarar, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Congress must protect net neutrality, ran the headline over an op-ed in an Iowa daily. Another one from California was headed, Congress must protect health of the Internet. Both columns espoused concern that the free expression and democratic access we associate with net neutrality are under imminent threat and congressional action is necessary. But wait a minute, didn't we get net neutrality in February when the FCC ruled that broadband internet service was to be treated as a public utility? Has something changed? Here to help us understand what's going on is Tim Carr. He's Senior Director of Strategy at the group Free Press. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Carr.
Hi, Janine. How are you?
Just fine. Well, activists were used to seeing policy victories undermined or even overturned once our eyes are off the ball. Is that what's happening here with net neutrality? What's going on?
With a lot of things in Washington, nothing is ever final. We had a very definitive decision in February of this year when the FCC voted 3-2 to classify internet service providers. These are the phone and cable companies that most of us get access to the internet through as common carriers. In that sense, they cannot block or throttle or in any way interfere with our online communication. That was a huge public policy victory. But we're talking about very powerful phone and cable companies here. And they have a very, very dominant presence in Washington, D.C. AT&T, Comcast are big spenders when it comes to lobbyists. They're big spenders when it comes to campaign contributions. And they have armies of lawyers who are at their beck and call. And they have deployed those lawyers to challenge the FCC's decision in the courts. They've deployed their lobbyists to try to get Congress to pass new legislation that would somehow take away the FCC's authority to protect the open internet. So we are still in the middle of a long battle.
As I'm reading these op-eds, they're saying that they are in favor of net neutrality. They're in favor of freedom of expression and no fast lanes or slow lanes, but that somehow, in order to get to that, they have to undo what the FCC did?
This is sort of the last-ditch effort in many respects for the phone and cable lobby. They used to say that net neutrality was a solution in search of a problem. And when nobody bought that, they tried to dismiss net neutrality as some effort to turn the internet into some public utility that was controlled by government. And when nobody bought that argument, they're now saying, well, we like net neutrality, but we want Congress to solve the problem. And the problem there is that what they've proposed to Congress over the last year have been rules that basically take away the FCC's authority to do much about the issue. So it's sort of like saying, well, you know, we like a clean environment, but we don't want the EPA to have any authority to punish polluters. So you really do need to read between the lines when you see these op-eds that have appeared throughout the summer. Many of them are very similar. They're suspiciously using very similar language. And you have to read between the lines and figure out what they're really trying to say.
Well, one of the things that appears in these op-eds is this reference to these are Ma Bell type regulations. And, you know, we're used to that in media policy issues. We're used to hearing, oh, it's a brave new world. We don't want this old style regulation. But I think the reference to Ma Bell is kind of funny because if you think about it, the telephone is the thing that, you know, it's a service that's provided, but they don't get to say who you can call and what you can say over those lines. I think for many people to reference the telephone service doesn't really turn people off the concept. They think, well, yeah, I mean, the internet has now become as crucial and as integral to people's lives as the telephone once was.
Well, what they're referring to when they say Ma Bell is a common carriage rule. And it's true, the common carriage was a rule during the Ma Bell monopoly, but it's also a rule that exists across the U.S. economy today. Common carriage is, you know, we're talking via telephone right now. That is a common carrier. Wireless devices, when you're talking about by telephone, are common carriers. It's a rule that exists throughout the economy. It functions in a digital age, and it did function back in the Ma Bell era. What they're trying to say is that this is outdated. The internet is, you know, of the 21st century. Why apply old rules to a new thing? It's sort of like saying the First Amendment is outdated. What common carriage does is it ensures that we have free speech protections over two-way communications networks, privately owned networks. And that's why net neutrality is important, because today you have hundreds of millions of people who are communicating via a digital platform. A lot of parts of that platform are controlled by private companies, and we need to ensure that we have basic free speech protections across all of those platforms, across all of the networks that make up the World Wide Web.
Well, activists did do, yourself included, a tremendous amount of work in succeeding in explaining how this kind of dull-sounding term, net neutrality, was actually crucial to the ability of groups, for example, to communicate and to organize and to have our own conversations without gatekeepers. It's not about how quickly you can download a movie. You know, it really is a political issue about our ability to maintain some kind of a public space. Well, some media lately have mentioned net neutrality as a thing that Donald Trump misspoke about. But what place, if any, do you see these internet issues having politically in the election? Is there a place? Is it something that people are talking about?
Well, it's slowly earning a place, and it's for good reason, because you look at a lot of the internet issues around which people have become very passionate. You look at the PIPA-SOPA battle. The PIPA-SOPA battle was a battle around copyright reforms. There was very draconian legislation that was going through Congress that was supported by the movie and recording industry, and tens of millions of people rose up to protect the open internet. The reforms that were being proposed by the industry would allow internet service providers to block certain websites. There was a very popular grassroots movement against that. There were millions of people who became involved in the net neutrality battle. There's been a very strong grassroots response for protecting privacy on the internet in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelation. So we have tens of millions of people in the United States who care passionately about internet issues. And they're not only people who will sign petitions or call their member of Congress, a lot of them vote as well. So as we enter into the 2016 presidential campaign, it behooves those candidates to consider that this is a powerful constituency. The internet is a constituency of people who are politically active and who care passionately about a lot of these issues. And so it's up to these candidates to incorporate an internet policy platform into their campaigns as well.
And we've been speaking with Tim Carr of Free Press. Tim Carr, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website. That's FAIR.org. That's also the place to show support for the show if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this week's Radio EcoShock show, we cover global climate news from the Syrian refugees to signs of an abrupt climate shift and everything in between with scientist Paul Beckwith. Plus, I've got a few tidbits of news they just won't tell you, and my new song aimed to promote activism for the Paris climate talks in late November this year. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go. Over the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, climate change put in an extreme appearance all over the world. It looks like 2015 will be the hottest year ever, another record-setting year in a string of hot years. Sooner or later, you'd think our civilization might begin to crack under the strain. Our next guest suggests a climate shift could be sooner than most people expect. It's time for our climate roundup with climate scientist and regular Radio EcoShock guest, Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, Alex. It's always nice to come and to have a chat with you.
Yeah, we'll have a good talk. And I want to start out with one of the biggest stories of our times. Just let me read one paragraph from a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences from March 2nd, 2015. And they say there is evidence that the 2007-2010 drought contributed to the conflict in Syria. It was the worst drought in the instrumental record, causing widespread crop failure and a mass migration of farming families to urban centers. And then they conclude that the severe drought was 2 to 3 times more likely due to human-induced climate change. And so, really, Paul, are the millions on the move out of the Middle East also climate refugees?
I think that the answer, the short answer to that is yes. I think climate change is the root cause. And of course, as the U.S. military often says, you know, climate change is a threat multiplier. So it can get things moving. It can trigger, say, the drought can trigger, you know, these crop failures, massive crop failures. And then in turn, the farmers have to do something. They tend to move to the cities or they want to migrate to other countries. And there's lots of unemployed people that are, you know, desperate and desperate for food, desperate for income. And, you know, they're very susceptible to taking up arms and fighting, you know, and so on, having fights over scarcity of food, scarcity of water, things like that. So you really need to look at it as a big picture thing. I mean, for people that say, you know, the Syrian, the refugee crisis that's hitting Europe, and I think we're talking about numbers of 3,000 or 4,000 people per day going into the EU. You can't say it's the war is causing it, for example. I mean, yes, directly, but that's a very simplistic view. Why is there the war? You know, how long has it been going on? What happened before? What was going on? And clearly the drought just massacred food production in many parts of that region.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the Iranians just had a day where the heat and humidity combined felt like 165 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 degrees Celsius. There were deadly heat waves, as you know, Paul, across the Middle East, extending into Pakistan and India. Is it any wonder a lot of people are deciding to get out to go somewhere cooler like Europe?
Yeah, I mean, you read my mind. I was just going to add that, you know, at the end of my last statement, but I thought I've talked long enough. I can let you have a question. But, yeah, I mean, the problem is that the regions that are near ocean bodies, normally they have a more moderate climate, right, because the ocean takes longer to heat up and longer to cool down. But the sea surface temperatures in some of those regions are 33 degrees Celsius. So they're keeping the temperature, you know, really, really warm. And if the winds are blowing, there's lots of evaporation. If the winds are blowing onshore, then it's carrying very moisture-laden air to coastal areas with that type of temperature. And you're reaching wet bulb temperatures of 35 degrees Celsius, which is kind of like an upper limit to human tolerance. So when there's 100% humidity at 35 degrees Celsius, the body, the core temperature rises of the body because you can't remove heat by sweating. you know, if that happens for a short period of time, day or two, then, then there's huge problems, huge fatalities, starting with the very young who are not able to sweat. So very young, you know, until you're about 5 or 6, I don't think you're able to sweat. So, you know, when a kid has a temper tantrum and their head turns bright red and you can feel the heat from their head kind of venting out, you know, because they can't sweat, right? and very old people, of course, you know, especially if there's some underlying medical condition. I mean, then, and, you know, but even people in prime of health, over a period of time, when the temperature is 35 degrees Celsius with 100% humidity, then the core temperature will rise, and the body systems will start shutting down. So we saw this happening in several places, and I never saw a report of the mortality numbers from those particular events, but I'm sure they were very high. I mean, we saw a similar thing in Japan, but not quite as high temperatures, right? That when the sea surface temperature around Japan was very, very warm, I don't know, a month or so ago, there were lots of fatalities in Japan arising from that because of the onshore winds were carrying that stifling air over major population centers there.
Well, a little later, we're going to talk about the blob that's been hanging off the West Coast. I don't want to quite go there yet because I want to return to Syria and something I've been thinking about. I mean, people get very hurt and upset when the Islamic State puts dynamite around the ancient temples in Syria and they blow up our common heritage. It's upsetting me. But really, Paul, we're doing the same thing with the ancient temple of nature. We put explosive barrels of oil and gas and tons of coal around the pillars that hold up the climate as we know it, and then we blow it up. I think our civilization, us, we're the real climate terrorists. How do you feel about that?
The really sad thing is completely unnecessary, right? I mean, it's completely unnecessary. If we had leadership that was based on science, you know, we've known a lot about climate change for a long time. We're getting more and more information about it, and yet it seems to be, you know, extremely difficult for society to change direction until things get so bad that that happens perforce because the general public is sort of up in arms about it. And, you know, this is like the tipping point in human behavior that I see and that I see, you know, us approaching quickly. But yeah, I mean, you know, it'll be interesting in the future to see whether well-known climate deniers and CEOs of oil companies that have, there's solid evidence that they've sent out fraudulent information and denial on the problem for years and years, you know, I would expect that there would be a backlash against these people by the public, you know. And you know, we need a carbon price, we need a carbon tax, and it's so easy to implement, and yet, you know, we tend, because of business interests and stock people, stock market people, they want to, you know, create this cap and trade market to do it, you know, a very complicated market that system that can be gamed but brings, you know, lots of profit to the brokers involved. So, you know, but it's not necessary, right, for humanity to be this stupid right now.
Well, let's get to the science on the Greenland ice melt. There's been a lot coming out about that the IPCC predictions of 1 to 3 meters for 2100. It's just out the window now because of new figures on Greenland ice melt. What have you been seeing on that?
There's a doubling period for the melt rate from Greenland and from Antarctica. And that melt rate, you know, in Hansen's recent paper on superstorms and sea level rise, he talks about a time period of about 10 years doubling period. But I think the number is closer, it seems to be closer to even 5 to 7 years. From what I can tell, and if you take a 7-year doubling period, you know, and project it out into the future, we're talking about a sea level rise of perhaps 7 meters by 2070, something like that. So that's a number that I've thrown out there, you know, just asking, can this happen? And if the doubling, you know, holds, then it will happen. I mean, it's not a question, you know, if we get, this is the nature of exponential growth. So, you know, is the ice sheet in Antarctica and Greenland capable of doing that? Now, Hansen makes the point that in Antarctica, there's a lot of regressive bedrock. So as you go inland, it gets deeper. And as you get the ice melting back, then it becomes unstable and can cause, you know, large nonlinear rise in sea level in Antarctica, you know, more so than in Greenland. But in Greenland, the problem is that the Arctic temperature amplification is so large, and the sea ice, you know, which we can talk about, is, you know, extreme. I mean, we should be calling it the Arctic Sea slush as opposed to Arctic Sea ice, I think. It's more like slush than ice. And we have at least another couple weeks, it looks like, before we reach the sea ice minimum. But Greenland's right up there. So when the sea ice goes and we get this large uptick in the Arctic temperature amplification warming, then Greenland will melt a lot faster. And Jason Box just showed this very interesting video that he obtained of somebody in an aircraft flying over a part of Greenland when there was a massive calving event, and it's beautiful video. I mean, you can see it's hard to get an idea of the scale, but the ice shelves are maybe poking out of the water about 100 meters or so. They break off, and then you can see they turn upside down, quite a few of them, and you can see the blue, just a very deep blue ice with no air bubbles, which was the basal ice of the ice sheet. Yeah, and so the Hansen paper, you know, it talks about numbers like 2 to 3 meters of sea level rise in the space of about 30 years. This happened during the Eemian, the previous warm period, and the Eemian temperatures being similar to that of today had a rise, was basically, well, 5 to 9 meters higher. It was 9 meters higher towards the end of the Eemian, and it's very similar conditions to today in terms of the temperatures and so on.
And, you know, people picture, Paul, well, okay, the sea goes up 2 or 3 feet, we'll lose a little coastal real estate, but when you realize that, first of all, it doesn't just come neatly even all around the world, that some places it piles up deeper than others, especially along the U.S. East Coast, and then you think about the storm surges, I shudder to think what will happen to coastal cities like New York and all along New Jersey, but also Shanghai and around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I just spent some vacation. I had 10 days on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and like really gorgeous area. You know, these are basically sandbars off the coast. I mean, they'll just be completely underwater. Yeah, I mean, the geography of the planet is going to be rewritten in the space of decades if this 3 meters, you know, in 30 years holds up. And the other thing is when you compare when we talk about, you know, global temperature rise as compared to the past, right? I saw an interesting chart by David Spratt just earlier today, and if you take the average global temperature from 1980 to 2009, then it's gone up 0.85 degrees compared to pre-industrial, so 1750. But if you take the average over the last 10 years, so basically 2005 to 2014, then the rise compared to that 1750 baseline is 1.07 degrees Celsius. If you take just 2014, 1 year, that number is 1.17 degrees Celsius. And if you take this year, January through July for 2015, we're 1.26 degrees Celsius above that 1750 number. So, you know, it's misleading when you look at a 30-year average or even a 10-year average. I mean, we're seeing yearly, you know, of course, this year is a very massive El Nino, you know, and it's very, very, very warm. I mean, the entire Pacific Ocean is 1.02 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. That's the anomaly. And parts of the El Nino off South America, I saw a number of 5.7 degrees. If you just go on Earth Null School, you know, and select sea surface oceans and sea surface temperature anomaly, and then zoom in on some of the hottest areas, that's the sort of number that you get, you know, extremely warm water. And the El Nino is still increasing in strength.
So how would we know whether the record heat so far this year is from just El Nino, or is it a real sign of global warming? How could we tell the difference?
First of all, the El Nino is behaving quite differently from a typical El Nino. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but for most of 2014, it was expected there would be a powerful El Nino, you know, like with 90% probability developing, and it took a lot longer. Of course, it didn't develop until beginning of this year. But when it, if you look at the temperature distribution of the water in the whole northern Pacific from the equator upwards, then as the El Nino is strengthening, then this warm Pacific blob is also strengthening. And then there's another warm Pacific blob sort of that splits between the equator and the latitudes, the high latitudes off Alaska. So there's these warm chunks of water. And of course, these are causing right now as we speak on Earth's Null School, if you have a look, it's, you can clearly see at least five cyclones churning away in the Pacific Ocean. Now, three of them, they're Category 3 or higher storms. And this is, I don't think we've seen this, having three cyclones, they're not called hurricanes when they're in the Pacific, typhoons, having three storms, Category 3 or greater, simultaneously churning across just sort of northward of, I mean, they're missing Hawaii, fortunately, but it's projected that at least one or two of them may end up heading right up into the Arctic over the sea ice.
And you have a new two-part video out called The North Pacific Blowtorch. Is that what you're talking about? What will viewers expect there?
Yes. I was talking about in that video mostly how unusual the warmth is in the North Pacific, how this warm, so-called warm blob that has been persistent, how it relates to the ridges of the jet stream, this ridiculously resilient ridge, how it relates to the long and intense drought in California, and how the very warm seawater is flowing through the Bering Strait, and it's undercutting the ice, it's melting the ice from below, and you can actually see some very clear collapses of ice over, you know, in less than a week, like huge thinning of ice, you know, mostly in the Bering, in the Bering Strait side of the Arctic. Well, also, I mean, we've got very warm water on the other side in the North Atlantic, and this is also undercutting the ice from below, and then we have very warm land surfaces in, you know, across Asia, you know, Siberia, that sort of thing. So the rivers are feeding very warm, fresh water into the Arctic basin as well. And then we get these cyclones up there, which churn up the ice and also cause upwelling of water. So the ice is definitely under siege. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, typically the end of the melt season, so the minimum of Arctic sea ice, it varies, the date varies from about September 9th to September 21st, something like that, typically. Last year was the 15th. I mean, last year I thought it would extend past the 15th, but once it started switching, it switched very quickly. So, but it, I think it's only a matter of time before that date starts pushing up. And also we're getting things like a few days ago, there was one of these century declines in sea ice extent in the Arctic. And these are very, very, I think we lost about, I don't know, 140,000 square kilometers. So we had a century event, and these are very unusual in late August and September.
But Paul, we're talking about warmer oceans, and yet when I look at a map of the world with the recent warming, there is one cold blob, colder than normal, just south of Greenland in the North Atlantic. What's that about? And also, would that affect the coming weather for the UK and Europe?
Yes. So there was a paper, if you'll recall, earlier this year that talked about, that found that the Gulf Stream, first of all, the Gulf Stream has shifted. So the Gulf Stream used to extend up where that cold water pool is, but it no longer extends that far up. It goes further south. So the net result is the temperature anomaly is much colder than normal, where we're seeing it just south of Greenland, and it's warmer than normal just south of that region where the Gulf Stream is now predominantly carrying the heat. And this paper was talking about how the Gulf Stream shifting, especially around 2009-2010, caused a sea level rise off of the east coast of North America by, you know, if, what was it, 5 inches or something over the space of that time period. So a massive, 125 millimeters or something over the space of, you know, over that time period, 2009-2010. And this was attributed to the Gulf Stream switching location. So that's one of the things. But the other thing that Hansen talks about is the increased calving and melt from Greenland is producing a lot of fresh and very cold water coming off Greenland. And that's also contributing to this cold water pool. Now, you can relate this cold water pool. It correlates very strongly with the blob over on the Pacific side. As the El Nino was ramping up in intensity, it was intensifying the blob in the North Pacific and also the secondary blob further south, as well as the El Nino equatorial water temperature. And as the Pacific blob was increasing in temperature, the south of Greenland, the water was cooling even more in that region. So I was talking about the ocean circulation in my last furnace videos, and I talked about Hansen's paper. I did a series of 9 videos dissecting Hansen's paper in the week that it was released. You know, I went into great detail on these so-called superstorms that he is attributing to very large, like, so this cold water blob south of Greenland and the very warm water south, it sets up a large temperature gradient over a short distance. So that creates a sharp pressure gradient over a short distance, and a sharp pressure gradient generates winds. And the sharper the gradient, the stronger the wind. So massive winds. And now we can see what happened. If you'll recall, the jet stream crossing the Atlantic reached record speeds. And so aircraft that were flying from North America to Europe set speed records. I mean, they had ground speeds, which is the speed relative to the ground, of, I think it was 700 kilometers an hour plus, almost 750 kilometers an hour. Like their airspeed of 500 kilometers an hour added to 250 to almost close to 300 kilometer an hour jet stream winds, which were, you know, we hadn't seen that type of wind speed before. So this is all related to those temperature differences and the cool spot and so on. And UK, just in the last few days, the UK has been hit by hail. It's been hit by lots of storms. I think in the last month or so, they've had lots of storms, lots of enormous waves and so on that are more they're more common in the shoulder season in the fall, when there's a struggle between the cooling air masses and the warmth that's built up over the summer. So we're seeing that earlier. So I think we're in for a massive, you know, uptick of extreme weather once again this fall compared to previous years. I mean, you remember all of the snow on the east coast of the U.S. Last winter, actually it was last fall, really. And the reason that was occurring is because the water off the coast was extremely warm. And when the wind patterns carried over that warm water, they'd pick up all the moisture from the evaporation and carry it over the continent, over the U.S. East Coast. And of course, as it was cooling because of the seasonal change, so we had massive snow dumps. And what strikes me is, and I remember one snowfall, I think it was maybe, you know, parts of Buffalo or something, where they got 3 feet of snow in these neighborhoods, and then a few blocks away, there was almost no snow. Like, there was just a wall of snow that came across and paralyzed everything in its path. And it was very well defined, so, you know, a little distance away, there was no snow or very little snow. So I think we're going to see, you know, it's like batten the hatches. I mean, these storms. Now, I mean, the superstorms that Hansen's talking about are things that we haven't experienced in the Holocene. Those are where you get enormous waves. And, I mean, his view is that it's not tsunami-caused waves. It's just long period waves of roughly, you know, up to 30 meters in height. And with the sea level rise in the Eemian, sea level being 9 meters ahead of, you know, 9 meters higher than we are today, plus the 30-meter waves from these long-period massive storms. They move boulders in the Bahamas because the fetch, you know, had a huge fetch. If they're coming, if the winds are from the northeast coming to the southwest, by the time you reach the Bahamas, I mean, you get the waves are the largest. You know, it's like on a lake. I mean, if you're at the downwind side of the lake, that's where the waves are, because the wave height depends on factors. It depends on the speed of the wind, right? The wind, the average wind speed. It depends on the fetch, which is the distance over which the ocean, the distance over the water over which the wind is blowing, and it depends also on the duration of the wind. If the wind is strong for a long period of time, then the waves build up over time, of course. So he's attributing these boulders and these chevron geological formations and so on in the Bahamas to basically this type of superstorm with 30-meter waves, persistent waves. And Bermuda, there's also signs that the waves were that big. In fact, there's some forests with 10-meter trees, 10 or 15-meter trees in Bermuda were completely covered by sand in a very short period of time, you know, a season or something, because the trees have fossilized and the records are all there. I mean, the trees were alive and growing, and they were covered, you know, they were completely covered in 15 meters of sand that would be brought up from the seafloor, you know, and with massive wave action, you know, on the north shore of Bermuda. But there is another possible explanation. So this paper, this Hansen paper, of course, was posted online, open, you know, sort of open, accessible to anybody, and it did have peer-reviewed reviewers being picked out, but also many comments, many public comments. And there's a number of comments from John Neeson with the group I'm in, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, and John thinks that is trying to build the case that perhaps it was very rapid when Greenland was warming very rapidly, and there was massive calving of enormous chunks of ice from southwest Greenland, for example. Then when these entered the water quickly, they could generate tsunamis, and these tsunamis would travel in across the ocean, some of them being reflected off the mid-Atlantic ridge sort of thing, and then coming down to the Bahamas. And perhaps it was a series of tsunamis that caused that. Those boulders to be moved 40 meters above present-day sea level rise. It's, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I haven't made a final decision on whether I lean more towards the Hansen superstorm idea or the tsunamis, and I think I have to go with the Hansen one. But John Neeson does have some convincing ideas that say that his idea might be the one. The reason. So he's written some things, comments that are publicly accessible. Anybody can go and read Hansen's paper and then the comments, and it's actually quite interesting to do so.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info. We're going to live in some interesting times. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He's from the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, we've just been through a period of record-setting wildfires in the West, and I've covered a lot of that already. Some listeners may say too much. But my question for you is, do wildfires contribute to global warming through the release of the carbon that was held in the trees and maybe blackening of Arctic from the ash, or does their smoke cool the earth and the newer growth will reclaim more carbon anyway? Do we know where that balance falls?
You know, you really have to always think of the time scale. So in the extreme short term, while the fires are burning, they're putting up a lot of ash, and typically dust particles in the atmosphere will wash out within about a week or so. And this is why, you know, if we stopped all coal-burning plants and oil you know, power plant oil burning for power plants, then the air would become a lot cleaner, and this we'd get a large temperature jump because of the global dimming phenomena that happens from all this particulate matter. So with the fires occurring, they can cause, you know, and of course the ashes moving long distances being carried by the air circulation, and over regions where there's very, you know, lots of ash, lots of smoke, that can cause a darkening, you know, that's through less sunlight, and can cause a cooling, but then the ash is washed out of the air quickly. As long as many fires are burning, then the ash is being continuously generated, right? So it can cause a short-term effect, but the net result is that you're converting the carbon, you know, from the vegetation to carbon dioxide through the combustion process, and that carbon dioxide is going up into the air. So you're giving the atmosphere extra pulses of carbon dioxide. So on the longer term time, you know, beyond the short time scale, it contributes to the global warming. It contributes to increasing the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere.
Okay, now, a lot of media coverage has been on the droughts, especially in the U.S. Southwest and California, and we've just talked about drying out in the Middle East. The thing is, Paul, we know a warmer atmosphere holds more, not less, water vapor. Will it come down only in extreme rainfall events, or will some parts of the world just get wetter and wetter?
Definitely what we're seeing is, you know, we're seeing this idea that, you know, wetter areas get wetter and drier areas get drier. So we're definitely seeing that sort of thing occurring. So the jet stream, the nature of the jet streams is changing, right? They're slowing, they're becoming wavier, they're more persistent. And so the storms that are carrying more water, 7% more water per degree Celsius, are depositing more, like it's taking them longer to traverse an area. So that area will have the torrential rain event, and that water that would have got elsewhere is not going elsewhere. So those are so the drought areas are getting drier. I mean, one of the things to look at is, you know, tree mortality around the world. There was just a study just within the last few days where they estimated the number of trees on the planet. And they did it. They think they are a lot more accurate than a previous study from, I don't know, about 6 years ago or something. And I think the number they came up with was something like, I think it was like 3 trillion trees or something. Mm-hmm. But what they do say is, and that was a lot more than the study in 2009. Those trees didn't appear. It's just that the accuracy, you know, of their counting using satellites and, you know, better data is, I mean, there's less trees now than there was in 2009. It's just the number is higher because they're counting more accurately. But the key thing is they figure that that's about half of what we had from 100 years ago or a few hundred years ago, right? We've reduced the tree biomass on our planet by about that amount.
Wow. All right, so moving on now, the Paris climate talks, are they a waste of time and carbon or what?
No, I mean, they're vital, but, you know, should we have high hopes that something will come out of it? You know, I mean, this is going to be COP21, right? So we've had 20 COPs with squat coming out of it, basically, right? I mean, we're not regulating emissions after 20 COPs, so why should the 21st one be successful? But the climate change is much more in the public space now. It's affecting many, many more people than it did before. There's starting to be more recognition, I think, with the public. So I think, you know, once this machinery of society starts to move, you know, to address climate change, like by slashing emissions, I think it can happen, and I think the speed that it will happen over will actually surprise a lot of people. You know, it'll be like turning on a dime sort of thing, is one expression.
Will you go to Paris, Paul?
I'm hoping to go to Paris, yes. I'm hoping to get accreditation, maybe with, you know, Ghana, like I did. I went to Lima, as you know, and had a lot of presentations and things, and I'm working to... it's not definite, but I'm hoping to go to to go to Paris. And, you know, I would add, I mean, there's starting to become pressure from lots of different groups. I mean, the divestment activities on fossil fuels are building. Coal, you know, another large coal company went bankrupt. There's lots of places are divesting from coal specifically, you know, although they're not willing to divest from fossil fuels completely. Of course, the Pope had, you know, his massive encyclical on, you know, and there's what, 1.2, 1.4 billion Catholics. And the Muslim community had their own, the Islam, they had their own climate change conference and had very strong wording that we need to slash emissions. And, you know, the groundswell is building. I don't know if, I mean, I spent 24 minutes watching the entire Obama speech from the Glacier Conference, it's called Glacier Conference in Alaska. And I think it's useful to listen to rather than, you know, most people will hear a few of the clips that he said, but I think it's worth listening to the full speech. And, you know, he kept repeating how important it was. Like, he seems to really start to get it. I mean, he's mentioned methane. He mentioned, you know, he kept mentioning the huge threat it is to society, and it's happening now. It's not something in the future. And, you know, I haven't heard him talk so strongly on climate change as he did on Monday of this week at the Glacier Conference.
I'm hopeful about that, even though he did just approve some Arctic drilling by Shell, which is kind of contradictory. But yes, Obama has come out with some stronger statements, and I have an inside channel into China saying that they are going to be pretty progressive in these upcoming talks, so there's some hope there. You know, another minor thing that bugs me, Paul, is why do they hold these talks in winter? I mean, Europe may get a string of cold winters, and it just helps the deniers diffuse the situation. I think they should be held in a heat wave during the summer, and maybe the air conditioners in the conference rooms should be turned off. That'd be more realistic and maybe add some pressure for real action, not, you know, 50 or 100 years from now.
yeah, no, I mean, that it's funny how sometimes, you know, things like that can make a big impact on the result. Right? of talks or, yeah, I mean, have the power fail, you know, have it in, you know, the Middle East in the middle of the summer, you know, let's see how many, you know, we'll have delegates keeling over from, you know, 30, 35 degree, 40, well, the temperature, you know, the heat index temperatures, you know.
Well, you know, that was part of the problem of Copenhagen in 2009. It was very, very cold in Denmark that winter, and he had people out there shivering in their big coats saying, we have to fight global warming. And, of course, that just led Senator Inhofe and the other deniers in the U.S. Senate to say, well, look, it's so cold. What are you doing talking about warming?
Yeah. I mean, it's that's you should suggest that to them, that they move to the summer where we know there's going to be a heat wave.
I'm sure they'll listen to me for sure. Look, I have an interview with a British scientist named Chris Bolton coming up, and I plan to ask him about the general idea that the climate may seem to stabilize right before it shifts into a new state. And I think this is partly what you're studying. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, if you look at sort of abrupt change theory, where you go along in one state and then you have a very rapid shift into another state or another regime, or, you know, you might have heard of the word bifurcation, where you have two different states and you can shift between one and the other, and perhaps there's hysteresis, so you can't shift back once you go. And one of the things, if you look at the frequency of changes, if you look at how quickly things change, or, you know, the noise fluctuations of the system, then often there can be a slowing down of the fluctuations, and just before the system will shift. So there's been some studies of looking at some climate shifts to see whether there was any evidence of this slowing down of the system of the sluggishness, but In some cases the slowing down was seen, but in other cases it wasn't. So I mean, people of course are very, you know, very interested. If there was a way we could look at the, you know, if we could predict a rapid shift before it happened. But there's other systems where the fluctuations actually increase in amplitude, and then the whole system shifts. So, you know, it's not, you know, it's, I think it's an active area of and it's not something that's new. I mean, people have, you know, electrical engineers have studied this when they're looking at how, you know, say a voltage can suddenly, you know, switch from a low to a high state, and, you know, what happens to the signals in between and so on. Or, you know, physicists, if you're looking at simple harmonic motion systems, or if you're looking at the vibrations of narrow resonance, if you like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, for example, you know, a slow forcing, which was a very, you know, mild breeze, but over a long period of time, it started setting up vibrations in this bridge, and it was tuned to a resonance frequency of the bridge, and the bridge started vibrating and eventually broke itself apart in this gentle breeze. And in that type of system, you know, you can have a slowing down of the vibrations, because as the fluctuations of the motion of the bridge gets more and more extreme, it's bending metal, it's causing stresses in the metal's not as resilient. Like, you know, an airplane wing, you look out and, you know, if it's turbulent, you see the wing moving up and down. That's a good thing, right? If the wing wasn't moving at all, then that's a bad thing, right? Because it's moving and it's flexible and it can, you know, stay within limits. So, you know, this is, so systems have a sort of a range over which there's stability. And then if you go outside of that range, you know, that's when you run into abrupt changes, you know, like bend a stick, you know, a little bit, and then take the pressure off, it returns to the way it was, bend it a bit more, you know, you can start deforming some of the molecules in the wood, and then it doesn't completely recover to where it is if you take the force off, and then, you know, apply a bit more force, and the thing just snaps, you get this abrupt change. Or, you know, think of, you know, in a canoe, okay, like you're in a canoe, you lean it over, and then center your weight, and it corrects, and you can keep doing this, and then you reach this sudden point, which is the point of no return in the case of the canoe, and you tip over. So, but some changes are not like that. Some changes are abrupt, and there's no sign whatsoever. You know, for example, an episodic stress, like you know, a meteor impact, for example. I mean, the system, there's no sign in the system that the meteor is going to hit and change everything. Right? There's no possible thing you could monitor on the Earth and anticipate that the meteor is going to hit. Right?
Well, I almost think of you go to work every morning in a car, and then one morning you go to work and you're in a very serious accident. There may have been nothing in that particular morning to indicate that was going to happen. So if that's the situation, is there any point trying to study whether there are signals that could indicate we're going to hit a climate shift?
Well, it is still worthwhile to, you know, do those studies and find out as much as we can about the different elements of the system and how they interact and how they are changing. I mean, I've been saying for years that I think, you know, our climate, I think we're well into an abrupt climate change situation. I've been saying that for years, but I mean, to prove it scientifically, we just don't really have, like, I don't think anybody can say that. Usually you look in the rearview mirror and you see, oh yeah, well, we did shift, right? That sort of thing. But I mean, relationships are like that. I mean, friends tell me that, you know, they thought their marriage or whatever was going just great, and then suddenly they're out on the street, sort of thing, right? And it's like, whoa, this, I never saw this coming, total surprise. And then, you know, after the fact, they maybe see signs that they didn't pick up on and so on, right? So, like, one of the things with abrupt changes is they're always surprising to us.
Right. Surprises. Now, look, I know it's a bit problematic to ask a scientist like yourself, Paul Beckwith, to speculate on how the future will develop. But personally, what could you imagine a sudden climate shift would look like to us?
Well, to get a long, detailed answer on that, you'll have to wait for my book to come out. If it does, if I can focus enough and get something written, because I want to, you know, have a non-technical, you know, discussion of basically what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and where I think we're heading. And I'll make it very clear, you know, what I'm what I'm speculating on versus what is well-known science. I mean, I generally, you know, I've talked about this in terms of the Arctic sea ice. So if we lose all of the Arctic sea ice, say, you know, before the end of this decade, so within the next 5 years, I mean, this year is setting up maybe the next year or two to be very interesting, you know, very risky for survival of the sea ice. So, but, you know, let's be on the conservative side. Let's say, you know, 2020 is the first year of no sea ice in the Arctic. So, and that would be for about a month or so. And then the extreme weather events, the jet streams go crazier, slower, chaotic. We get more and more weather extremes occurring. We get possible crop failures globally and turmoil within a year or two after the sea ice is gone for the, you know, maybe up to a month. So the month of September, the first year, or a couple of weeks, and within a few years, because the ice isn't cooling the region and there's a lot more absorption of heat in the dark water, you know, ocean temperatures go up, perhaps a methane release causes another feedback, then we have no sea ice for, you know, maybe 3 months of the year, so maybe August, September, October, you know, in a few more years, you know, 5 months or 6 months of the year are free of sea ice. The Arctic continues to warm. You know, Greenland melt is exponentially rising even at a faster rate than before. And then within about a decade of the first blue ocean event, no sea ice event, then we have a warm Arctic year round. And it stays warm throughout the winter season. We don't get ice reforming because the water temperature is extremely warm, you know, throughout the entire Arctic Ocean. And as a result, there's more evaporation. So there's more low-level marine clouds. So these marine clouds basically trap the heat. So the heat doesn't radiate out to space at nighttime. It's trapped. So we have a period, we basically have a different climate, completely, you know, different system. And there's lots of questions are, you know, is there any jet stream at all? I think there could be a very weak jet stream because of the, there'll always be a humidity gradient. The equator is always going to be more humid. The Arctic will be drier. It'll be humid, but not as, of course, not like the equator. And then that humidity gradient could set up a weak jet stream. You know, what happens with the Antarctica ice? What happens with, you know, the, like there's all these other different interactions. And so, yeah, I mean, this is something I've been struggling to come up with a decent scenario. And, you know, it's subject to change, you know, quite a bit with me, but it's starting to consolidate on a number of different features. You know, it's the details that are changing, not the overall gist of things. So I thought, you know, I'm reaching the point where I think I just need to sit down, lock myself in a room for a couple of weeks and just write a book.
I'd like to read it. I'd like to read it for sure. I think we're going to have to wrap up there. Listeners, you can follow our guest Paul Beckwith on Facebook and through his up-to-date and always informative YouTube videos. Beckwith is B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. Just Google that. And you can find links to all of that in my Radio EcoShock blog. I publish it every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I know we could have talked for another hour on the upcoming changes to the world, but as you say, we'll look forward to it in your book.
Well, I guess I've committed myself to a book.
You're committed now. Just in your spare time, Paul, aside from working on your thesis and your videos and all the other things you do, thanks so much.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks again. And I got hit by climate change a week ago.
I got
some poison ivy, and it's horrible. I think the poison ivy is strengthening. The potency of the sap is strengthening under climate change.
Wow, I had it as a kid to the point where when I went to grade 8, they called me Poison Ivy. That was my nickname in the schoolyard. And the bad news is, Paul, that it can come back. Your skin has a memory. It can come back for like 2 or 3 years after that in the same places.
Yes.
Even though you don't have recontact.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I think it comes up in places where you didn't have any contact. It's in your system.
Yeah.
And you have the initial contact with the leaf, you break out in those areas, and then within days you start breaking out in other areas, and then it takes us several weeks to get rid of it. So there's also the hogweed, and there's wild parsnip. Those are things that people should look at and make sure they recognize what they are, because they're just as bad as poison ivy these days.
The plants will change. The bugs will change. We're not alone. Thanks again, Paul Beckwith.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
News they just don't tell you. In climate news they don't tell you, Paul Beckwith talked about the heat wave that hit Japan this past August. It was hardly reported in the West, but here's a short clip from Vice News, August 6th.
A heat wave has killed at least 40 people in Tokyo. Temperatures soared above 95 degrees Fahrenheit for 6 days in a row. More than 11,000 people have been hospitalized. Japan's aging population is particularly vulnerable to the heat. Nearly half of those treated were over the age of 65.
But there's a huge story lost in the mix of Western celebrity news, the refugee crisis, and the developing stock market crash. It's this. Eastern Europe has been baking under a heat dome for over a month. Here's a clip from Ukraine Today on August 11th explaining how carbon-polluting coal plants can be shut down due to their own climate-wrecking impacts, this time in Poland.
Europe's heat wave has forced Poland to sharply cut electricity supplies to industry for the first time in over a decade, pushing some companies to limit production. Prime Minister Jerzy Kopacz called the situation very serious, as weather forecasts for the coming days showed high temperatures are to persist. The local unit of the world's largest steelmaker, ArcelorMittal, halted some of its operations, describing the situation as very difficult. The heat wave and lack of rain cut the amount of water needed to cool coal-fired power plants, from which Poland generates about 90% of its electricity. The country has virtually no solar energy generating capacity. Temperatures in Poland topped 30 degrees Celsius last week and may reach 39 degrees this week, according to Poland's Meteorology Institute. In Romania, ships faced slow progress along the Danube River after days of hot weather left water levels low. Navigation was particularly difficult, especially at Zimnitsia, 125 kilometers southeast from the capital Bucharest.
The heat in Ukraine itself just keeps on coming. On September 3rd, the capital Kiev ordered a shutdown of the school system due to continuing extreme heat plus smoke from peat bog fires. Burning peat was the source of the pollution that helped kill over 10,000 people in Russia in 2010, including many in the capital, Moscow. Once set ablaze, peat can burn for months, perhaps into the winter, and releases a lot of extra carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Peat fires in Indonesia covered much of Southeast Asia in the winter of 1997-98 and made Indonesia the world's third largest source of carbon dioxide that year. Peat fires are also sending up smoke in western Russia, easily seen by satellite. Check out Robert Scribler's blog, dated September 3rd, titled Smoke from Peat Bog Fires Blankets Europe and Russia Amidst Record Heat and Drought. According to the Associated Press, September 3rd, quote, Kiev broke an all-time record for September 1st when the temperatures reached 35.5 degrees Celsius, 95.9 Fahrenheit. Rainfall in August was just 4% of the average, according to the local weather forecasters. Health Ministry spokesman Svyatoslav Protas said air pollution in the Ukrainian capital on Thursday was twice to 18 times higher than normal levels, depending on the neighborhood. My thanks to listeners who sent in these tips of news they just don't tell you. During my summer break, I worried what to make of the upcoming climate conference in Paris. My starting contribution is a new song called In the Streets of Paris. If you like it, download it free from my blog at ecoshock.info or from the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. You can also share this tune through social media using the SoundCloud links or embed the music in your own blog or website. I hope you will. Please tweet your brains out about this. We're going to need all the help we can get to pressure world leaders to get real in Paris, to save the climate and our descendants from horrible heating, extreme weather, rising seas, and massive extinction. Thank you for listening again this week. I've got lots of great guests coming up for you in the next few weeks. Here is In the Streets of Paris.
Heat is building, records falling, revolution time has come. Suits and limousines, all important people, meet in locked off rooms. From outside our voices, calling save the climate. From the streets of Paris, oh yeah. Say you don't need to fly there. Every street we meet on is Paris where we live. Late this November, late in climate time, we all meet in our streets of Paris. Oh yeah.
In the streets of Paris.
They deal to corporations, pulled by billionaires. They need to hear the people. Now and in the future, we demand the action. Get off that carbon train. In the streets of Paris. Humans grow in numbers, economies in size, an atmosphere of poisons flies into the skies. Meet me in November, green me in December, hold their feet to the climate fire. Let us all remember, fate hangs in the balance, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris. Driving on is easy, oil slaves are great. Doing nothing is the mantra in the sinking ships of state. Oh, we all fall into a stupor. We all fall into a shock. We're burning golden energy and no one wants to stop. My grandchild looks in innocence. What's in our will? Storms, floods, and fire. Society is ill. Leaders in your finery, remember the Bastille. Listen to the shouts now, if only you will. In the streets,
in the streets of Paris.
Friends, you know the score. Wherever this may find you, promise to take action and show them what you mean. Pull together now in the winter of 15. Make your main street crowded. Stand up where you are. The bell of time is ringing. The bell of time is ringing in the streets of Paris.
the streets of Paris. In the streets of Paris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada. The
Intifada Electronic.
The Intifada Electronic.
The Electronic Intifada.
I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. We continue our podcast special on Gaza, 1 year after the 51 days of Israeli attacks. I sat down with the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Charlotte Silver, at her home in Oakland and asked her to talk about her recent time in Gaza and the West Bank. Silver began by talking about what she covered while in Gaza a year after the attacks.
Yes, it was the first time in 3 years going back to Palestine and the first time ever going to Gaza. And so I had sort of a list of stories I wanted to pursue. Going in, and actually once I got there, I saw a very different place than I could have ever imagined. And it really, you know, it made the sort of the word blockade, siege, these words that we use to describe the state of and condition of Gaza kind of have meaning that, you know, I was in this place that was, you know, if I went up to the 11th floor of a building, I would be able to see the green trees of Israel, but other than that, you feel like you could be in another country, you could be on the other side of the world. You feel so far away from both Israel and also the West Bank, even though every movement of Palestinians in Gaza are controlled by the occupation and the siege. One of the most profound experiences I had again and again and again was talking to people about... you couldn't have a conversation for longer than 10 minutes without someone talking about how they wanted to get out and talking about their options of how to get out. And even with those options, how the small likelihood of that succeeding. And, you know, you feel in people's energy sitting at a table, walking around, the restlessness and the confinement that they're in. I mean, Gaza is a tiny place. You can't go anywhere. It takes longer than 20 minutes, and there's an entire population made up of mostly young people who can't look into their future without seeing these small parameters, these small borders. They have ways of trying to hope to get out. And the heartbreaking thing about a lot of these plans is that it involves separating from their families and not knowing when they will be able to come back. That's the constant, and that's been this way for 8 years, acutely. I went almost exactly a year after last summer's war, and I was there for the month of Ramadan, and there was, at that point, not a single home had been reconstructed because of the inability to get reconstruction material in. And I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the reconstruction material and all other sorts of materials haven't been able to get into Gaza since long before the war. And I spoke to people who had their houses destroyed in 2003 during the Second Intifada. They haven't had their homes restored, and they're also living on international aid because of this. So the destruction to Gaza is something that predated last summer's war and continues to go forward. It's not just the 12,000 homes that were completely destroyed. It's much more. It's much broader, deeper. It's not just that travesty that happened last summer. And I think that's important to point out. But it's so overt to see blocks of not only destroyed homes but the rubble. And that's mostly still there. There are places where they've managed to get rid of the rubble, and some homes that were partially destroyed have been able to get some materials to repair. And I think last week the foundation for the first home to be rebuilt was laid in Shajaiya. But no matter what has begun, the rate at which materials are allowed to go in is so slow that people estimate that it'll take up to 20 years for just what was destroyed to get rebuilt.
Not counting, you know, the destruction that was laid in previous assaults and also the destroyed infrastructure because of the siege.
Right, and what will be needed to accommodate the growing population. For a photo story that I did with Ez Al-Zanoun about families and people a year after the war, we found these people in the first few days of Ramadan, and we wanted to talk to them about what this month was going to mean to them, considering how they endured it last year. And we met one man. We went to Beit Hanun, which was it's in the north of Gaza, and it's right on the border, and it was blocks and blocks of just completely destroyed homes. And we went about doing the story by just sort of walking around and striking up conversations with people. There were people who were outright hostile to talking to media. They felt this sort of resentment of people coming in, scooping up a story and leaving. But there are also the large majority of people are very generous with their time and telling their stories. And these are stories that are not easy to talk about. And so in Beit Hanun, we came across a man named Ali Zaki Wahadan. And his story was one of the hardest to hear and to ask him to tell, because he was sitting, now is in a wheelchair, he's lost one leg, and his other leg he may not be able to keep his other leg. And he lost 12 members of his family in two separate bombings. And he allowed us to sit down and talk to him about what happened last year. And he didn't want to talk. He didn't want to talk about his wife that was killed, his mom that was killed. What actually happened to his family was he left the home in Beit Hanun to take his brother to a hospital. And meanwhile, Israeli soldiers descended on his home, arrested all the men, except one older man, arrested all the men, took them out of Beit Hanun, and proceeded to occupy the house and use it as a military base for over a week. And as this was going on, Ali's sister was sending him text messages that she had hidden in her pocket. The soldiers had put them all into one room, kept them there. You know, we're giving them food. They didn't report being tortured. They were kept prisoner and hostage in one room of this house as they sort of used the house as their military base. Sister was sending text messages for this week to Ali. Then the soldiers left, ordered the family, which included Ali's mother, father, 2-year-old niece, to not leave the house. And within 24 hours, the house had been completely destroyed and demolished, and everyone in the house was killed. Ali found this out when he returned and found the home demolished. And there's no moment to mourn. It's just that he was able to return to Beit Hanun during a very brief ceasefire. He immediately went to a relative's house in Jabalia to seek refuge, and 2 days later, that home was also struck, and he lost more members of his family, including his 22-year-old wife. And you just, you know, you look at these people who have suffered unimaginable loss. The entire structure of his family was obliterated. His home was obliterated. And there's very little comfort that you can think that they can hold on to, because it's not necessarily the last time it's going to happen, and there's no end to the kind of prolonged suffering that really is inflicted on Gaza.
We're speaking with Charlotte Silver at her home in Oakland, California. Charlotte, what struck you the most, maybe what was most surprising about this latest trip to Palestine and the reporting that you did over the couple months that you were there? And what, maybe what images, what stories do you keep kind of coming back to and thinking about the most?
I think that being able to go to Gaza for the first time was just incredibly important. And I think that there's this tendency in the press, you know, from mainstream press to more left-wing press, to emphasize the sort of constant crisis that Gaza is in, using kind of blanket terminologies like Gaza is a ghetto, Gaza is destroyed, Gaza is rebel. And that really does belie the culture and the life that and the vibrancy of Gaza that exists. And it turns what is a crisis, like a war, into a sort of trivialized, you know, just another ding on the drone of Gaza's destruction. And I do think it's important, and it's not just, you know, a sunshine story to talk about what is in Gaza, honestly. You know, there was a lot of reporting, especially around the year anniversary, talking about how the war could have been yesterday or the war could have been last week, and that's not true. I mean, the hundreds and thousands of little children who were absolutely traumatized, speechless from trauma from the war, they have recovered. In a lot of ways. They are speaking now, and they are laughing, and people are talking about the incredible healing that has gone on for a year. And that's not to say that there is not still trauma being held by everyone, but there's no reason not to acknowledge what Palestinians in Gaza have managed to achieve this past year.
Charlotte Silver, you're a contributor to the Electronic Intifada and also to The Nation and with Al Jazeera as well. Charlotte, thank you so much for all that you do and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. San Francisco Bay Area-based artist Naima Shalhoub told the Electronic Intifada back in January that, quote, in August 2014, when the attacks on Gaza were happening at the same time as the Ferguson protests and the wider call to draw attention to police brutality against black and brown people, the grief was overwhelming. As an artist, I couldn't help but write a song attempting to draw the connections between the two. Shalhoub added, quote, both peoples experience oppression stemming from the global prison industrial complex. It is no coincidence that Gaza is the largest open-air prison, while the United States has rampant incarceration rates and death rates of black and brown people. Commemorating a year after the Israeli attack on Gaza and the uprising that began after the police killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, we now listen to Naima Shalhoub's Ferguson Gaza Blues.
Ferguson's looking like 1963. with the 16th Street Church and Medgar Evers' memory. And Gaza turned gray from the ashes of apartheid. They don't care, they're killing children, 'cause they on the devil's side. They say they send troops so that they can save lives, while they fund the massacre of those that resist to survive. They hold the hand of murderers and feed him more weapons as children die before them, as they shout the last wishes. They say that this land is the leader of the free, but black is still segregated. When are things turning? 'Cause things don't seem to change. Gotta keep our fists raised, 'cause it's time to rearrange. Oh, when are things turning? 'Cause things don't seem to change. Gotta keep our fists raised, 'cause it's time to rearrange. Applaud the bravery of Mandela's raised fist. But if he was still alive, he'd be on the terrorist watch list. Your words have no meaning when defense is genocide, guys. But the day is coming near when this mask will be your demise. When are things turning? 'Cause things don't seem to change. Gotta keep our office raised, 'cause it's time to rearrange. Oh, when are things turning? 'Cause they don't seem to change. From underneath the rubble, a child still survives. And so is the truth that slowly starts to rise. Thank you for receiving that.
That was Naima Shalhoub singing Ferguson Gaza Blues. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Between the Lines.
Well,
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper, who assesses the Fight for 15 campaign organizing for higher wages at fast food restaurants and big box retailers across the country. Scott Semple, commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction, who talks about implementing a more humane and dignified approach to running prisons that makes for a safer environment and better outcomes. And Eve Spangler, associate professor of sociology at Boston College, who discusses her new book titled Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite warnings issued by the British Labour Party establishment, veteran backbencher and socialist Jeremy Corbyn is the top contender to lead the Labour Party on a strong anti-austerity agenda and skepticism of foreign military intervention. Corbyn, who vows to scrap Britain's Trident nuclear missile program, has a 20-point lead in polls over his rival centrist candidates for party leader. The Labour Party suffered serious losses in the last election against Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron and lost all but one of their seats in Scotland. In a rejection of centrist New Labour fashioned by Tony Blair, Corbyn wants to renationalize key industries. He has also called for a people's quantitative easing, which would mandate the Bank of England to finance large-scale housing, energy, and transport projects with the goal of creating 1 million new skilled jobs. Other candidates for the leadership of the Labour Party accuse Corbyn of wanting to turn the centre-left party back to the pre-Thatcherite 1970s. But Corbyn has surprised many pundits by winning key labor union endorsements, has attracted big crowds, and brought new blood to the Labour Party. Through the campaign, Corbyn has criticized previous Labour governments for promoting economic policies that exacerbate inequality in Britain by favoring the service sector at the expense of traditional blue-collar jobs. Results of the Labour leadership race will be announced on September 12th. Florida's entire Republican establishment, from Governor Rick Scott to U.S. Senator Marco Rubio and former Governor Jeb Bush, all dismissed the threat of man-made climate change to the Sunshine State. Yet Eric Carpenter, head of the Miami Beach Department of Public Works, is paying close attention to tidal surge. He has the latest flood maps and is trying to figure out how many new water pumps the city will need to stop ocean flooding. Local mayors have joined the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which has emerged as a national model. The cities involved in the compact have agreed to make preparations to confront a predicted rise in sea level, identify the most vulnerable flood-prone areas, and are reviewing more than 100 recommendations for action. This initiative is moving forward without any federal or state funding. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Miami Beach is one of America's most vulnerable cities to sea level rise. Even on calm days, water can fill local roadways, creating traffic jams and disrupting commerce. The city is now installing 80 new water pumps at the cost of $400 million to drain rainwater from city streets. Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine observed, "We are on the tip of the spear. We do not debate the reason why. We just come up with solutions." Resistance from heavy industry and Republicans in Congress has led to a standoff in implementing new occupational health standards, which could endanger the lives of thousands of workers. Over the past 20 years, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has issued 7 health standards, in contrast to 6 rules adopted in 1978 alone. According to the Center for Public Integrity, most of OSHA's exposure limits are over 40 years old, and tens of thousands of chemicals, including some that are known hazards, aren't addressed by OSHA regulations at all. While the metal hexavalent chromium emitted during chrome plating and certain welding operations and used in products such as specialty paints can cause cancer, the chromium industry has worked for decades to stop or delay the implementation of regulations. According to documents filed by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the industry spent $500,000 on a health study to call into question earlier research. But when the study found the current exposure limits weren't adequate, the industry suppressed its own findings. Since 2010, worker advocates have been lobbying for the passage of the Protecting America's Workers Act, which would strengthen safety enforcement by increasing civil and criminal penalties. But the measure faces strong opposition by industry-funded politicians, including Minnesota Republican John Klein, chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee, who has raised nearly $1 million from industry-backed donors. But Dr. Sammy Al-Mashat of Public Citizens Health Research Group doesn't see much difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to improving workers' health. He says both parties are essentially corporate-funded. It's infused a culture in the regulatory process of extreme deference to industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
It's been almost 3 years since the movement for a living wage burst into protest, first in New York City, and then dozens of other cities and towns across the U.S. In its short lifespan, the National Campaign for a Hike in the Minimum Wage has seen significant victories, including announcements from fast food giant McDonald's and America's largest retailers, Walmart and Target, announcing they would increase the base pay for their lowest paid employees. Elsewhere, 11 states have legislated minimum wage increases, and major cities including Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles have passed measures that will over time phase in a $15 hourly wage. The National Workers Alliance, known as Fight for 15, is backed by the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, which has initiated other successful organizing drives, including the Justice for Janitors campaign. SEIU has spent millions on organizing major protests, job walkouts, pickets, and a sophisticated public relations campaign designed to move public opinion in favor of minimum wage increases. A recent National Labor Relations Board ruling will make it easier for unions to negotiate contracts for employees working at fast food chains and other companies with franchises using contract labor. Your reporter spoke with Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper and widely published journalist. Here he examines the strengths and weaknesses of the Fight for 15 campaign for higher wages that he's written about in an article titled Wage Gains Won't Last Unless Fight for 15 Builds Worker Power.
SEIU has spent tens of millions of dollars. By my estimate, they've probably spent 50, maybe over $100 million. They put an enormous amount of money into this. Now, to their credit, they have played a key role in terms of moving, getting this movement in terms of the wage. The first place for it to happen was Seattle. A lot of the credit, though, also goes to Socialist Alternative and Shama Sawant, who was elected to the Seattle City Council in the fall of, I believe it was 2013 now. And, you know, SEIU deserves a lot of credit for it. But this is not a worker organizing campaign. This has to be understood as a public relations campaign. It's a march on the media. What they have been very effective at doing is kind of creating a lot of essentially shaping the message, helping shape public opinion. They work with different groups like Labor Projects, National, I think, Employment Law Project. They've come out with all sorts of studies about wage theft. You know, something like 83% of fast food workers are subjected to one form of wage theft or another. They've come out, you know, with all sorts of, you know, great reports on just, you know, the horrendous conditions fast food workers have to live under, how they depend on billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies to survive. And so they have really helped shift the opinion. And of course, this was also coming in the wake of Occupy Wall Street, right? It was Occupy that really shifted the debate from economic austerity to income inequality. So that has helped the Fight for 15 tremendously at this point. So now we're finally seeing these victories, and we should not discount them at all. But we have to remember the real principle of worker organizing is building worker power, right? That the workers have to really be the ones who decide and take the initiative. And that's not happening at all. This is very much stage managed. When I talk to organizers and workers themselves, it's like, are you being trained in guerrilla tactics in the shop? How to build, how to organize a shop, how to like build resistance on the shop floor? And virtually none of this is going on across the country. So it's kind of this more staff-driven and very much leadership-driven strategy. There are a few people in SEIU's national office who are essentially making the decisions. Maybe it's half a dozen, maybe it's a dozen people, but it's a small number of people who are really directing the campaign.
From your research for this article, what is the objective? What's the goal of the Service Employees International Union in sinking all this money and organizing time into rallying workers for higher wages? Do they want to win elections and win over dues-paying members, or is there some other objective here?
You know, I talked to one of the senior most labor strategists in the country, and he, you know, on background, filled me in on how campaigns like this operate. And he said there's never one strategy. It's essentially a series of nested strategies that you're trying to push all these things forward at once. So one is that SEIU does want to organize workers. It's very difficult. And now with the NLRB ruling about joint employers, there's finally a path where they may be able to negotiate with the fast food giants. It's still not going to be easy. Part of the thing is they do also want to help improve the condition of workers, but that's also to make them look better. Another strategy is also they're trying to at once curry favor with Democratic politicians, but also show them that they're a force to be reckoned with. This is why they're concentrating in a lot of urban areas. So there are all these different strategies going on at the same time. It's never about any one thing.
Arun, do you find any hope in this workers' movement to go beyond where SEIU is taking them?
We have to, you know, say that this has been a real important victory. Let's not lose sight of that. You know, no one thought $15 an hour was possible when it began. But I will just say it's going to take a lot more. The struggles are more than biological reproduction. As important as wages, housing costs, medical care, all those are, that is not what we, and by we I mean people on the left, socialists, communists, anarchists, are fighting for. We're fighting for a different world, how we think about work, society, community, family relations, gender relations. And you're only going to do that by really creating forms and structures of radical democracy. And this is the last thing SEIU wants to do.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. Find more analysis and commentary on the National Movement for a Living Wage by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut recently made headlines when the state Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to carry out the death sentences of 11 men on death row after the state abolished the death penalty in 2012. When the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that banned capital punishment in 2012, the measure exempted those inmates already sentenced to death. But on August 13th, the state's highest court ruled that the death penalty was cruel and unusual punishment, and the 11 men awaiting execution will have their sentences converted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Connecticut's new commissioner of the State Department of Corrections, Scott Semple, took over as acting director in August 2014 and was confirmed in the post this past January after being nominated by Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. He comes to the job with 27 years' experience in the system, beginning his career as a corrections officer, then serving as a warden, and later as the Department of Corrections liaison with the state legislature. Governor Malloy and Commissioner Semple have pushed to repeal mandatory sentences and improve programs to help ex-prisoners find jobs, naming this broader initiative the Second Chance Society. Semple has been hailed by many grassroots criminal justice reform advocates as a man of compassion, a trait they say is sorely lacking in the system in general. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Commissioner Semple after he attended a recent meeting with reform advocates in New Haven. Here he discusses his plans for reform and programs already put into place to make inmates' incarceration more humane and to ease their way back into the community upon release.
And when it comes to wellness, you know, we're talking about some of the things that occur in correctional environments, such as trauma and vicarious trauma and things of that nature. And over time and through experience in general, people take those exposures for granted, but they really have significant impact. So there is some indicators that suggest that you can go in the direction of a more humane and dignified approach with accountability, that you can lower those types of incidents and everyone is better for it, not only the staff, but the inmate population. What you will find in Connecticut and throughout the country in terms of how correctional facilities are designed, I call them stadium construction. You know, when an incident occurs in a correctional facility, everyone gets exposed because everyone is aware of it. It goes throughout the population. There are a lot of things that happen, and I think that we've been going in a direction that takes a more dignified approach in terms of how we manage inmate populations, and we're starting to put some metrics into evaluating as to what we do has an impact and supports those strategic initiatives that I mentioned.
Scott Semple, I understand you recently returned from a visit to Germany to learn about criminal justice there.
About 6 weeks ago, I returned from Germany. I was invited, myself, several other commissioners and advocates, a whole host of professionals to just see and look what the European system looks like. Governor Malloy was there with me, and what we saw was a very dignified environment, and the whole makeup of how they operate, there was some interesting aspects of, you know, their approach, and I did get to see that the vast majority of these folks, when they leave, they are employed. They have the ability to sustain themselves, and I thought that that was attractive, but what was most attractive as it relates to trying to take a dignified approach within correctional facilities is that one of the facilities that we had went to, which would be the equivalent of a level 4 maximum security environment for calendar year 2014, had zero incidents. So that's very limited trauma, if any. So that was extraordinarily attractive to me. So I am still evaluating, you know, what we can do here in Connecticut that may mirror or mimic some of the aspects of how they manage that population. You know, it was worth seeing, and it was worth seeing a system outside of this country. I've seen many systems in this country, so it was very exciting, and there were some interesting things that they do with the juvenile population there, which is primarily 18 to 25 years of age, and they really focus on the whole discussion about brain development, and I think as our population lowers, we may be able to entertain some of the theories that go along with that.
There have been recent attempts to scale back the numbers of Americans, especially men and women of color, who are incarcerated. Where does Connecticut fit in that effort?
You know, historically, we know that there's some people refer to it as hyper-incarceration or mass incarceration. It definitely has been a huge financial burden on state budgets, federal budgets, and alike, county budgets. Connecticut's unique because it's a consolidated system. I have an obligation, and our agency has an obligation, to be responsive to the taxpayers, and that is the direction that I received from our governor, to try to have an impact on this population in terms of his launching of the Second Chance Act. It's very, very expensive to incarcerate people in Connecticut, not only in Connecticut, but throughout the nation. And if you just have a 5% reduction in recidivism, just within corrections, that equates to about $12 billion in savings. That's a substantial amount of money, but if you take it even further, there are other savings, you know, within local government and things of that nature, when, you know, police and all different types of public safety entities that could be a cost saving as far as a social impact as well. It is about creating law-abiding citizens, but it's also about sustainable incomes, but people have to feel better about themselves. It's just not get a job, and that solves the problem. If that was the case, this initiative would be a lot easier to address.
That was Scott Semple, Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction. For more information and analysis of Connecticut's innovative corrections programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While world attention understandably has been focused on the bloody wars in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen that have produced a massive wave of immigration to Europe, not seen in many decades, the intractable Israeli-Palestinian conflict goes on. Flashpoints of violence between Israelis and Palestinians rise to the surface on a regular basis, symbolizing the failure of multiple international efforts to resolve this conflict since the founding of Israel as a nation-state in 1948. The senseless death of three members of a Palestinian family in the West Bank village of Douma is but one of many similar incidents. A firebomb attack on the home of the Dawabsha family on July 31st is thought to have been carried out by Jewish extremists, but no one as yet has been charged with the crime. The latest member of the family to die was 27-year-old Riham Dawabsha, mother of 18-month-old Ali, who died on the day of the attack. 8 days later, his father, Saad, also died. Ali's 4-year-old brother, Ahmed, is still being treated in hospital. A new book written by Eve Spengler, associate professor of sociology at Boston College, explores the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict by examining important chapters of that complex history, the concepts of Zionism, anti-Semitism, liberation, and possible new paths to a negotiated settlement. Your reporter spoke with Professor Spengler about her book, titled Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Here she discusses some essential truths about the conflict, of which many Americans are unaware, and a possible human rights framework that could lead to a resolution of the long-standing conflict.
So let's start with Israel and Palestine together are a little bit larger than the size of New Jersey. There are about 12 million people there, almost exactly evenly divided, 6 million Israeli Jews and 6 million Palestinians, some of them Christian, most of them Muslim. And so we're confronted with a kind of paradox. Under, you know, theories of democracy, you have communities, each of whose individual members is of equal human worth. Human rights doctrine has to start with the worth and dignity of each individual. And two communities of roughly equal size, 6 million each. This could be a formula for democratic, peaceful, prosperous living together, but instead these relatively equally worthwhile individuals in equal-sized communities are confronted with this terrible paradox. One is an occupier and one is the occupied. The occupier has a modern Western technology state with a high standard of living, with unlimited American diplomatic, military, and financial support. And the other group are stateless people, in the case of the almost 2 million who live in Gaza, probably also mostly homeless people. And this struggle between an occupier to expand and maintain an occupation and an occupied people to come to some more just terms to live an ordinary life, that is the paradox of Israel-Palestine.
Eve, I wanted to ask you about the consensus that has been built since the 70s, mm-hmm. Around a two-state solution, mm-hmm. from Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat to Clinton and Obama. A lot of the negotiating sessions that have been held between Israelis and Palestinians over the years has been around a two-state solution. It seems that in the last couple of years, there's a recognition that this may be a dead end, not least of which is the continuing failure to reach anything like a two-state solution. Benjamin Netanyahu publicly declared his opposition to the two-state solution, coming out of the closet on that one. Eve, maybe you can explain what the alternative to a two-state solution is among activists in Israel and Palestine, and yourself, too, who have gravitated towards a different way forward for a solution.
On the left, there has been some thought among leading Palestinian intellectuals that the Palestinian quest for a normal and decent and fair life needs at some point to abandon the framework of a national liberation struggle. They need to say to Israelis, hey, you know what? You've won. You've got all the land. You've got all the aquifers. You've got all the roads. And hey, guess what? You've got all of us, too. Now, where do we sign up for voter registration? Where do we sign up for our national health insurance card? So there are some Palestinian intellectuals who've thought that way, and they have undertaken to work with Israeli intellectuals who agree with them. And so there's a lot of work going forward, very quietly, never covered on the media, about what would water look like in a one-state solution? What would land rights look like? How many refugees really could return? Where would the roads go if they weren't only connecting illegal settlements back to Israel proper? How would you have a grid that served everybody? How would you have a power grid that served everybody? So a lot of that planning is already going forward on the left, and that's what I've gravitated toward. Because the two-state solution was really never enthusiastically endorsed by either Zionists or Palestinians.
Well, Eve, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you this one last question, and that revolves around the major point that you've raised in this book, and that is that you believe that to move forward to a long-term peaceful solution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we have to start in the framework of human rights. And although we don't have a lot of time, maybe you could spell that out for us.
Absolutely. I think human rights are valuable in their own right because they insist on the dignity and worth of individuals. They're also, I think, important to us because they're looking toward the future. The premise is everybody who's here gets to stay here. No one gets pushed into the sea. Now, how do we do it so that everybody gets treated decently? And lastly, I think human rights are important because they do require some action. The truth is not halfway between Martin Luther King and the Ku Klux Klan. The truth isn't halfway between the Union and some sweatshop owner. The truth is the truth, and it needs to be stood up for. So I think human rights gives us a place to stand without being Middle East experts, without speaking all the languages, but knowing some of the history. It gives us a place to stand, at least to ask that America use the standard of human rights in relation to this conflict.
That was Eve Spangler, Associate Professor of Sociology at Boston College and author of the book Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Find more views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
You're listening to an excerpt from a new book authored by me, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and my co-author, Steve Vittoria, written in the spirit of the legendary historian Howard Zinn. The big title, Murder Incorporated. This is an excerpt from the chapter, The Murderers of the World Arrive in the Americas. There is no more glaring distortion in the history learned by generations of Americans, in textbooks, in schools, in the popular culture, than in the story of Christopher Columbus, Howard Zinn. They came from feverish, fetid cities and sewers of a repressive Spain, driven by dreams of avarice, poor, young, maddened as hatters they were. For their homes, their villages, and the rapidly vacated prison cells held no promise. Their cohorts to the west would later leave the crowded, loud, vaporous, and unjust realm of British princes, with mirages of money, gold, land, and wealth swimming in their diseased retinas. They left the cold, clammy, rainy shores of home to enter what must have seemed paradise, the balmy, sunlit shores of Turtle Island. They each and all met beings of a rare and unblemished beauty, sun-kissed men, women, and children, living in virtual gardens of a kind of Eden, resplendent with health, vitality, and love of their lands, their gods, their cities, and even those storm-tossed, haggard, smelly, fish-colored strangers. For though they spoke in strange tongues and wore rough, ragged, stinking tunics and had metals they had never seen before, were they not people? Were they not also human? What does one do when one sees people in hunger, in distress, ill, and perhaps a bit mad? What's the worst that can happen? People help people, yes, even strangers with thick tongues speaking gibberish. This, the peoples of the lands that would one day be called the Americas did. They tended wounds. They fed the hungry. They taught the stupid fellow beings how to farm and how to listen to the land that was the mother of us all. How could they know that this was the worst thing they could do? How could they know that this sick, feverish people would repay their kindness with genocide? How could they know that these blue-eyed godmen, greedy people, would turn on the hands that fed them, and not just bite them, but slice them from their attached sinews and bone, bind them in chains, rape their daughters and mothers, corrupt their sons, burn their villages to ash, and wipe them from the face of their mother, wipe them from existence? From these sailors, these shipmates, these explorers, would come a holocaust of epic and ungodly proportions. For the peoples of Turtle Island, the Aztec, the Maya, and a million other clans, bands, and tribes had nurtured a ravenous beast which would leap at their throats, destroy their lives and dreams, and wreak unholy havoc and terror on the world under the guise of liberty. The world would be transformed by the loving kindness of the people we have come to call Indians. For in welcoming these foreign peoples into their homes, they opened the door to almost total destruction. This story, the end of their world, marked the emergence in the brief span of five centuries of one of the most ruthless and voracious empires this earth has ever seen. Why should you destroy us? It would be nice to think that things could have evolved differently in the Americas. Some historians blissfully write a kind of hope history, as in what if Columbus did this, or what if Da Gama did this? These are mere mind games, word plays of wasted time, for things happened as they did, because regrettably, the forces launching those ships across the surging seas were powerful and deep. But truth be told, neither Spain, England, France, nor Holland were nice places, for the simple fact that much of Europe was a cesspool of disease, of class and religious conflict, of social and official violence. That is to say, it was a place ripe for leaving. When written accounts were published about a land of honey, of endless spring, of sweet flowing waters, imagine the psychological forces drawing on such people to this new, fresh, clean land. Oppressed at home under rapacious nobility, threatened with the sulfurous fires of hell by a venal, sacerdotal class hungry for indulgences, the seaward route to this new Eden must have seemed like a great escape. Millions of Europeans would be drawn to this new Europe, a place where every dream could be made reality, if only those pesky Indians weren't in the way. This is not to suggest that the southern Europeans had an identical view as their western colleagues, For the Spanish saw these teeming lands as a place rich in slaves, while their brethren of England wanted the land, with the natives preferably gone. Where they united in view and action was the ruthless extermination of Indians by hook or starvation, and if all else failed, by Christianity. When the Spanish hit the Indies, they burned through those societies like a hurricane of fire, while villages perished by the lethality of the disease they imported. Cities once vibrant with life, commerce, and culture became charnel houses of bone. When the Spanish encountered indigenous people, they chained them, recited the cruel requerimiento to people who hadn't the faintest notion of what they were saying, or even its intent, and enslaving them, sent them into the mines for gold or silver. The document read to them had the following message. I certify to you that, with the help of God, we shall powerfully enter into your country and shall make war against you in all ways and manners that we can, and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of their highnesses. We shall take you and your wives and your children, and shall make slaves of them, and as such shall sell and dispose of them as their highnesses may command. And we shall take your goods, and shall do all the mischief and damage that we can, as to vassals who do not obey, and refuse to receive their lord, and resist and contradict him. On Sunday, 14 October, 1492, Cristóbal Colón, a.k.a. Christopher Columbus, wrote in his diaries, El Diario de Cristóbal Colón, the following passage that clearly underscores the burgeoning European motives of hegemony and conquest. From the outset, slavery was also in the air. Columbus's observance is an obvious harbinger of the transatlantic slave trade lurking on the horizon. After the obligatory salutation, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, Cristóbal Colón speaks from the heart. The people here are simple in warlike matters, as your highnesses will see by those seven which I have ordered to be taken and carried to Spain in order to learn our language and return, unless your highnesses should choose to have them all transported to Castile or held captives in the island. I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I pleased. The Spaniards wanted the natives alive, if only to work for them as gold slaves. The English wanted their land, period. They had little use for living natives, and yet, even this is a bit of an exaggeration. For as historian David Stannard informs us, the numbers of people left dead in the wake of the Spanish gold hunger is, to say the least, staggering. This brief paragraph should more than suffice. By the time the 16th century had ended, perhaps 200,000 Spaniards have moved their lives to the Indies, to Mexico, to Central America, and points further to south. In contrast, by that time, somewhere between 60 million and 80 million natives from these lands were dead. Even then, the carnage was not over. Somewhere between 60 million and 80 million natives dead, extinguished, slaughtered, liquidated. That's how these Americas came to be. They are the bones upon which this beast was fed and raised. This was the Europeans' response to those who succored their sick and starving, wet and cold voyagers from the sea. Many Americans are aware of the name Pocahontas, recognizable if only because the name was used in a popular Disney film, which tells the story of a beautiful Indian maiden who saves the life of a white guy. There is, in fact, a basis to this tale. But as in most American Disney-fied history, much is left out. There was a maiden named Pocahontas, and she did save the life of John Smith. What American history books usually exclude is the reply given by her father, Juan Sonacook, who lived between 1547 and 1619, known to the whites as Powhatan. When Smith threatened him about a year after his life was spared, the father of Pocahontas responded to Smith's threat thus, "Why should you take by force that from us which you can have by love? Why should you destroy us who have provided you with food? What can you get by war? We can hide our provisions and fly into the woods, and then you must consequently famish by wronging your friends. What is that cause of your jealousy? You see us unarmed and willing to supply your wants if you come in a friendly manner and not with swords and guns as to invade an enemy. I am not so simple as not to know it is better to eat good meat, lie well, and sleep quietly with my women and children, to laugh and be merry with the English, and being their friend to have copper, hatchets, and whatever else I want, then fly from all, to lie cold in the woods, feed upon acorns, roots, and such trash, and to be so hunted that I cannot rest, eat, or sleep. In such circumstances, my men must watch, and if a twig should but break, all would cry out, "Here comes Captain Smith." And so, in this miserable manner, to end my miserable life, therefore, exhort you to peaceable counsels. And above all, I insist that the guns and swords, the cause of all our jealousy and uneasiness, be removed and sent away. And what instead was sent away? The dozens of clans, tribes, and nations of the Powhatan Confederacy, a united force of more than 30 such peoples covering hundreds of miles in area. "We fed you," the tribes exclaimed, "in 1,000 or 500,000 tongues. We broke bread with you or smoked the pipe. How could you be so evil towards us?" By the time comprehension dawned on them, it was too late. So many of the people had perished, and too many Europeans were flooding these shores, north and south. This is an excerpt from the chapter, "The Murderers of the World Arrive in the Americas," from a new book, Murder Incorporated, authored by me, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and my co-author, Steve Vittoria. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What geostrategic ambitions are being achieved by the global war on terrorism triggered by the attacks on the World Trade Center towers 14 years ago? In what ways has the 9/11 truth movement been undermined in the time since the attacks? What do we know about the extremist Islamic terror groups and their links to U.S. and Israeli intelligence? Have there been any significant changes to the game plan of the U.S. and NATO powers which the 9/11 attacks helped to serve? With ISIS becoming the new official villain, is it possible that 9/11 is no longer needed to provoke the current military agenda? As we mark the 14th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we get perspectives on the fallout from the event as it has established itself through the expansion of the U.S. and NATO military power. Providing us with their perspectives are last week's guest, FBI whistleblower and Boiling Frogs Post editor Sibel Edmonds, and Michelle Chosadovsky, Emeritus Professor of Economics, author, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. On this week's program, The Evolving War on Terrorism, examining the post-9/11 military doctrine. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 11th, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Today, the 9/11 Consensus Panel releases two new consensus points, presenting evidence of official foreknowledge of the attacks. The first point deals with Able Danger, the code name for a high-level intelligence operation co-founded by Generals Hugh Shelton and Peter Schumacher, Commanders-in-Chief of the Defense Department's Special Operations Command, SOCOM. The second new consensus point shows that the attack on the Pentagon was expected in several quarters before the event. Several pre-9/11 military exercises involving planes flown into the Pentagon suggest that such an attack was not unexpected. That comes from the article, New Evidence of Foreknowledge of the 9/11 Attacks, from the 9/11 Consensus Panel, posted September 9th, originally appearing at consensus911.org. On the 18th of August, the U.S. aid recipients beheaded the 81-year-old Dr. Al-Assad for his refusal to reveal where many precious artifacts had been hidden, according to his son, who was kidnapped with him but released. The body was hung from one of the great Greco-Roman columns, his head placed between his feet. Many have written that Iraq and Syria's glorious archaeology survived even Genghis Khan's repeated assaults on the region, but not the U.S. and its terrorist beneficiaries. Genghis Khan, that's Supreme Khan of the Mongols, King of Kings, lived between 1162 and the 18th of August 1227. The 18th of August was when Dr. Al-Assad was so appallingly murdered nearly 800 years later. That comes from the article, The War on Syria and the Death of Civilization, The Assassination of Dr. Khaled Al-Assad, Guardian of Palmyra, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted September 9th. It's no secret that Syria's government is a major arms, oil and gas, and weapons ally of Iran and Lebanon's resistance political group Hezbollah. This coalition and meddling in Syria came about immediately on the heels of discussions of an Iran-Iraq-Syria gas pipeline that was to be built between 2014 and 2016 from Iran's giant South Pars field through Iraq and Syria. With a possible extension to Lebanon, it would eventually reach Europe, the target export market. Indeed, tensions were building between Russia, the U.S., and the European Union amid concerns that the European gas market would be held hostage to Russian gas giant Gazprom. The proposed Iran-Iraq-Syria gas pipeline would be essential to diversifying Europe's energy supplies away from Russia. That comes from the article, Migrant Crisis Fueled by Gas Pipelines, by Minar Muhoesh, posted September 10th, originally appearing at Mint Press News. In spite of Habyarimana's peace efforts, violence escalated to such an extent after his assassination that Rwanda went from being viewed as a potential success story in the early 1980s to an unsolvable basket case in 1994. That year, the international community deemed the situation in Rwanda so unmanageable that it pushed, quote, for the complete removal of UN troops because it didn't want UN troops to stand in the way of Kagame's conquest of the country, even though Rwandan Hutu authorities were urging the dispatch of more UN troops, unquote. The UN, which had been inactive during the genocide, was afterwards forced to uphold victor's justice to justify the socio-political and financial chaos it had created in the region. Therefore, it created the ICTR and tasked it with upholding the Hutu extremist narrative at all costs through the common law system. Later on, this assignment also required suppressing all future evidence pointing to the RPF's complicity in Habyarimana's assassination. That comes from the article, Who was behind the Rwandan genocide, debunking the Hutu extremist myth? Why the ICTR refuses to examine the assassination that triggered the Rwandan genocide, by Guillaume Cress, posted September 9th. If real investigative journalism was still alive and kicking in our corporatized, for-profit media environment, and if exposing big lies was still regarded as important in our dying democracy, the blacklisting of 9/11 truth seekers and the court of law-worthy evidence that they have collected would have been celebrated and not denigrated. But the absurd, official, media-blessed version of what happened on 9/11/2001 has proven to be totally false, and the consequences of the failure of our leaders – to admit that they have been bamboozled by the big lie have been devastating to the world. The consequences of the illegal and fraudulent invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, orchestrated under the guise of several big lies by the Cheney-Bush administration, are still being played out in the millions of war refugees in the region that are desperately trying to leave the war-torn nations that the Pentagon helped to destabilize. The endless wars that began in earnest after 9/11 and the Constitution-shredding Patriot Acts and Homeland Security Act had all been planned long before the Three Towers came down, and the recurring wars of retaliation, Saddam tried to kill my daddy, G.W. Bush, and resource theft, oil equals Operation Iraq Liberation, had likewise been planned ahead of time. Critics of American imperialism totally understand that great Satans make good use of big lies. That comes from the article, 9/11 Truth, Debunking the Neocon 9/11 Narrative, The Workings of Big Lie Propaganda, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted September 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. It has been 14 years since the attacks on the World Trade Center towers shocked the world and drove forward a so-called war on terrorism. The war has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in conflicts ranging from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya, Palestine, and Ukraine. Legislation embraced by Western countries from the U.S. Patriot Act to Canada's Bill C-51 have led to the restriction of civil liberties. Tremendous levels of spending have been redirected away from programs of social uplift toward the military, and particularly the various technology and other firms that profit from war. A stubborn 9/11 truth movement arose as revelations of problems with the official story have come to life. Among the more robust is the group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now names over 2,300 professionals with credentials in the fields of architecture or engineering who are on record as doubting the explanation of how the Twin Towers collapsed. On this week's program, we examine the fallout from 9/11 with a particular emphasis on the wars and aggression spawned in its wake. Sibel Edmonds is the editor of the Boiling Frogs Post and founder-director of the U.S.-based National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. She is the recipient of the 2006 Penn Newman's Own First Amendment Award and the author of two books, including her memoir, Classified Woman, The Sibel Edmonds Story, a memoir, and a work of fiction, The Lone Gladio. She was recently interviewed by Global Research NewsHour contributor Jonathan Wilson. Here she is reflecting on 9/11 and its legacy.
Just because it's the 14th anniversary of 9/11, and, you know, there was a lot of information coming out in the years following, and then there was the official report. You testified at the 9/11 Commission, and as far as I know, nothing that you said made it into the report, right? It was all classified and
sure, they put a footnote saying that they interviewed me and got the documents, information. However, they were all covered by the state secrets privilege and classification. Yeah. So I made it to this footnote, or at least the information I provided became a footnote. That was there, but that was not going to be published.
Right. So what is, I mean, now looking back, like, what is your opinion about, you know, what took place? I mean, you know, we could see who benefited, but it's, you know, it's still something that people wonder about, and that kind of opinion and idea that, you know, inside forces were involved. It's very prevalent still. But it seems like the media will never touch it. What do you think of, you know, kind of the general idea of what was behind that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, again, that's both based on my short tenure with the FBI, subsequent events that followed it, the sources and people I have gotten to know. from various fields relevant to what happened in 9/11, the fact remains that it was a major false flag operation. Now, I could never I can never offer any kind of details saying, okay, so let's talk about Mohammed Atta, you know. But, again, there's so much research out there with facts, documented facts on these actors who supposedly carried out this major terror event, synthetic terror event, and the fact that they were going to, they needed to have this event, this terror event in the United States, and they conceived the idea. They even publicized it in 2000, a year before 9/11. I mean, there's this document called PNAC, P-N-A-C, the Project for New American Century,
right, yeah,
with the signatories, and some of those signatories, they were the names under the files that I told you about, this special counterintelligence operations. You know, you're looking at people like Douglas Feet, you're looking at Richard Pearl, you're looking at Wolfowitz. They actually spelled it out, and they said, this is a chance. We're at this crossroad as a nation, with the fall of the Soviet Union, to become the singular, one and only global superpower. And there's so much that needs to be done. We need to take over the Middle East, Eurasia, which ends up being Central Asia / Caucasus, and that we need to do this. This is the obligation of U.S. to establish itself once and for all as a superpower, period. However, to do this, the United States needs the backing of public, and for that to happen, it just doesn't seem likely. Think about it. For 50 years, we milked this notion of communism and the big, bad, scary Soviet Union with their nuclear powers, and by doing so, justified spending trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars on military-industrial complex and the intelligence-industrial complex, and opening and putting in place all these bases, military bases all over Europe, you know, and in, including in South Korea, in Asia. Well, with the Soviet Union dissolving, the public here, people in the United States started saying, great, now that we don't have this big, bad, ferocious, scary, scary enemy, let's do things for our country, you know, whether it's for our own poverty, for our education, for transportation, for infrastructure, for welfare, for all these kinds of things that we have been lacking because we have to put all these resources and make all these people rich within the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And so basically, PNAC's designers, authors, they were saying, people are not going to accept that. We can't just go and starting this dominance goal and implementing it with the Soviet Union gone. However, the only way for us to achieve this objective of permanent absolute dominance hinges upon a major catastrophic terror event here in our country, in the United States, on our soil. Because if we had such an event, and this is for people who are not familiar with PNAC, because I'm sure many of your readers, knowing global research being one of those very, very few real alternative sites with wealth of information, so many of your listeners are going to say, oh, God, don't I know all about it. But just in case there are people who have not looked into PNAC, they said, and this is simplifying it, they said, we need this event. And the event has to be like Pearl Harbor. It has to be in the United States, and it has to be big. They put this, they sign it, it's out there, it's a public document, and lo and behold, a year later, that exact event that they wanted takes place. Now, if you are one of those highly skeptical people saying, you know, there are coincidences in life, then you have to then pause and say, okay, what followed that terror event? One by one, going through the objectives and the goals listed, the other objectives outside the big terror event in the United States, and PNAC saying, you know, with Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, you know, places like Libya, what we have been doing with candidacy of Georgia making Azerbaijan a NATO member. I mean, with the Soviet Union gone, think about it. NATO should have been dissolved, right? Why would you have NATO? NATO was established as a counter to communist Soviet Union's military power in the region, in Europe. The North Atlantic Organization, its sole purpose of existence supposedly was that. Mm-hmm. Now, with the Soviet Union gone, I mean, you were looking at having this organization, useless organization, dissolved, right? Not only we did not dissolve it, we ended up expanding NATO. One by one, first chopping some of these Eastern Bloc nations, getting three nations out of one, no longer having Bulgaristan or Czechoslovakia or et cetera, but putting bases, military bases in Poland, the NATO bases, then start moving towards Central Asia Caucasus, putting a NATO base in Azerbaijan, inviting Georgia to become candidate. Well, that was made possible. This was the vision. This is the goal of PNAC. That started taking place as a result of 9/11. Attacking Iraq, which was an objective, was accomplished right after 9/11. So not only that the event took place, one by one, we started doing what was spelled out in that document. So when you get this, and this is the simplified version, and you put together with all the leaks, all the whistleblowers, all the documents that have been made available to the public, granted, not via mainstream media, it is not something that can be considered crazy, nutcase, conspiracy, far-fetched kind of a theory.
Right.
You're looking at it is far more substantial as a fact than any other fable, fantasy, stories that have been fed to the public to date, whether some box cutters doing that and Al-Qaeda or what they are selling today as ISIS. So I guess that would be what I would add or present as 9/11 to date. And I have to also say that it's hard not to be pessimistic because the vigorous movement started dying down,
yeah.
and now we don't see it as much, which was the intention to start with, to begin with. And I have to also give credit to the establishment, to the deep state and its mainstream media by coming up with really innovative, creative ways to kill the movement. I mean, we had so many false pretend agents put out there as 9/11 activists or groups that discredited the movement tremendously. It hurt the movement tremendously. And now many people have started looking at it as another fringe minority group, such as the Kennedy assassination, researchers. You know, how many years have passed since Kennedy's assassination, and still nobody knows what happened, you know, the real facts. And 14 years since 9/11, and are we heading towards the same kind of situation, the same kind of a direction? I certainly hope that we are not.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. After writing this book, writing The Lone Gladio, testifying, giving interviews, many other honorable whistleblowers, researchers who have done tremendous amount of work, seeing the public's response, or more accurately, lack of response, is frankly discouraging, and it's hard not to become pessimistic.
For sure. And I wanted to, I don't know if you have much of an opinion on this, but what do you think of the, one of the groups that's still pushing, trying to get 9/11 information out there is the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and the theory that the Twin Towers in Building 7 fell because of planted explosives. What is your opinion of that, like the idea that happened?
Well, it's very hard for me to form an opinion because one of the things I have done, with everything I have said, everything I have written, I have made sure that I would stay within the facts that I know of, that I can support and I can back up, back. Mm-hmm. and not engage in any speculation and not having expertise in that area, it would be foolish for me to say, well, yeah, I can see that because, you know, the left brain, right brain thing, politically, geostrategically, I can with confidence talk about what's going on in the region or Operation Gladio, Turkey, Middle East, because that is my background. It is within my field of study, but I have never, ever had gained any knowledge or information from anything that is related in any way to engineering. It makes me pause, and I would not dismiss it whatsoever, because when you have hundreds of engineers, architects, and these are experts, come together, study, research, look at it, collectively come and put forth their theory or what they believe it happened, you can't dismiss that. I mean, unless none of them have the degrees, you know, how could you just go ahead and dismiss and say, oh, well, that's crazy. But on the other hand, because I haven't spent much time studying the issue and I don't have any expertise in the engineering or architecture field, I won't be able to make a case for it or against it. All I would say is I pause and I always listen, and dismissing it would be foolish because, as I said, you won't dismiss if you have 500 doctors. Forget 500. If you have 50 licensed practitioner doctors come and say certain things, let's say about vaccination, would I dismiss that? I don't think so. I will never dismiss such a thing. In fact, I would say, and it does happen. Unfortunately, we don't get the numbers. I don't want to get outside the topic of vaccination. Mm-hmm. But any of these doctors who have come forward challenging a lot of studies and research and talk about the negative aspects of certain vaccinations, they have been pushed out of the industry by the pharmaceutical giant corporations, mega corporations, of course, the lobby and such. The same thing goes for these groups of architects and engineers. I would not dismiss it, but I can't add or I cannot informedly, intelligently engage in any discussion not having that expertise.
Well, that's pretty much all the time we have. Really appreciate this interview, Sibel. And is there anything else you wanted to add or maybe say just about, you know, the 14 years later, and the fact that, you know, it's 14 years pretty much since you went through, you know, what happened at the FBI and have been pushing this information since. Like, what would you say about, you know, this journey that you've been through in the past 14 years?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question because, you know, what happened was initially, and I'll do this fairly speedily. Sure. I was really blaming the political system. I was at the beginning of this journey when I went to Congress and they were shut down by the Justice Department and the CIA because they actually placed an official gag via retroclassification on U.S. Congress, which is completely against anything that is in Constitution. It was if Congress were doing what it's supposed to be doing instead of these, you know, sold out, awful, corrupt politicians, we wouldn't be in this position. Then when I went through the court system, it was, my goodness, and you get to see these judges and federal courts, and you see that when you're going against the government, federal government itself, and these are federal courts, you are not dealing with an independent, separate entity. And I kept saying, had they been doing, or if they were doing what they are supposed to be doing, you know, serving the public, the truth, the justice. So I went through this whole thing by pointing, saying how wrong these parts of, I mean, the whole Congress and the court system, and you see how corrupt it is. Then, of course, came the time when I saw the mainstream media, whether they were censoring or blacking out or twisting or printing just plain lies, and the systems, governments, deep states, marketing firms pointing finger at them. After all these years, after I would say around 2009, 2010, I came to this realization, my own realization, whether right or wrong, that a lot of it actually boils down to we the people. And a lot of the blame actually lies with the people in this thing that, yes, the apathy, sure. A lot of it is system created, whether it's through our education system and our mainstream media and the movies, etc. But people can't shrug that responsibility and saying, well, I'm so busy with work or this is the only thing that was available to me, because we see others who are countering that and overcoming that. So I would say my biggest disappointment has been with people, has been with the level of apathy. And as long as we have that, the optimism to overcome and to change things, the hope for it dims. And that's why informing the public and having trying to counter those forces, whether it's the education system or the mainstream media, it's a must. And with that, I have to say that global research has been doing that, because I discovered global research about, I would believe, around 2011, 2012, and I have a list of sites that I put under my favorites. So every morning I go through those websites to read truly alternative editorials and news pieces. Well, global research has been there, and it gives me hope, you know. And I can count, maybe not using both hands, the number of true alternative medias. I distinguish between pseudo-alternatives, the ones who are backed by the exact same establishment that backs the mainstream media, either the Soros Foundation or the Carnegie, or you're looking at the Koch brothers. I would say the ones I believe in, they are less than 10, and global research is one of them. So I think, and I believe, you have been doing great work, all of these people who contribute, authors, the journalists, the videos you put out there. So while things are making me pessimistic, especially public, the apathy, there are things that give me optimism, and one of them is seeing that at least they exist. The number is not there. The alternative media sources, outlets, but at least it's there. And that is a cause to, I guess, hope and celebrate.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. It has been 14 years since the U.S. and its NATO partners responded to the 9/11 attacks with a determination to wage a global war on terrorism, the notion being that there were radical groups mostly centered in Islamic countries determined to wage aggression on so-called free countries in the West. It has been the editorial position of the Global Research website and this radio program that the war on terrorism, so-called, is mostly a front for waging aggression to secure the ambitions of imperialist countries and their regional partners, which are not necessarily connected with security or the spread of democracy. With nearly a generation separating America's Pearl Harbor from today's international scene, we take a moment to reflect on the role of 9/11 in galvanizing current military activities. Has the war that former Vice President Dick Cheney said will not end in our lifetimes evolved or altered course in any fundamental way? Joining us to discuss the post-9/11 military doctrine is Michelle Chosudovsky. Michelle Chosudovsky is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa. He's founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He's the editor of Global Research and the award-winning author of 11 books, including America's War on Terrorism, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War, and his most recent, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. So thank you very much for joining us, Professor Chosudovsky. Going back briefly to the attacks themselves, do you want to maybe name a couple of points that convince you that this was essentially fabricated?
My first reaction was to say, well, assuming that Al-Qaeda is behind these attacks, and knowing the history of Al-Qaeda going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, then I would say that the CIA, as a state sponsor of Al-Qaeda, was behind these attacks. That was my initial reaction, namely the relationship between Al-Qaeda and U.S. intelligence going back to the Soviet-Afghan War, late 70s, early 80s, suggested that Al-Qaeda, being a U.S.-sponsored intelligence asset, and if this U.S.-sponsored intelligence asset it was involved in the terrorist act, then the sponsors are also involved in the terrorist act. Now, in the course of those 3 weeks separating the 11th of September to the 7th of October, some very important things occurred which have a bearing on the whole doctrine of the global war on terrorism. First of all, Afghanistan, through diplomatic channels, the Afghan government contacted the U.S. State Department and said, if you have credible evidence that Osama bin Laden was, preliminary evidence that Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, we will gladly deliver him to the U.S. justice system. Now, that was transmitted through diplomatic channels, and President George W. Bush reacted to this invitation by the Afghani government and said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And that was the end of it. There was a subsequent diplomatic memorandum which was set repeating this offer to deliver Osama bin Laden to the United States justice system. And there was, of course, no follow-up. And then on October the 7th, the war on Afghanistan broke out. And anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning knows that you don't prepare a theater war of that magnitude in a matter of 3 weeks, which signifies that the war on Afghanistan was already in the pipeline. It was on the drawing board of the Pentagon well before 9/11, and that 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, was ultimately the pretext and the justification for waging that war. Now, that war then led to subsequent wars, and the narrative was very similar. The military doctrine, which then became embedded in Pentagon manuals, is that we have to wage a war against the terrorists, irrespective of the so-called collateral damage that this might cause to independent sovereign countries. And then if we look at the history of those 14 years, we have a sequence of military operations which are part of a roadmap, and certainly Cheney indicates the existence of this roadmap, and so does the Pentagon when they talk about the long war. The long war is a Pentagon concept, but that long war is a humanitarian war, and the humanitarian war is under the auspices of going after terrorists with a view to protecting civilians and so on. So that 9/11 is the building block of the global war on terrorism. It is the building block of U.S. foreign policy, and that's why 9/11 truth is the greatest obstacle to U.S. Aspirations with regard to conquering the world, extending economic frontiers, and so on. Because without 9/11, their whole justification for waging humanitarian wars collapses like a deck of cards.
Okay, let's talk about that game plan for a moment. Do we know what that game plan is? And has that game plan been in place all along, or did that 9/11 turning point, was the main point of 9/11 just to galvanize support for this pre-existing war plan, or did it has anything changed since then about like where they go and what countries they destabilize and so forth?
Well, the game plan since the Soviet-Afghan War has been to train terrorists, to recruit them, and to finance them. And this happened in country after country. In the wake of the Afghan War, you had Bosnia. Bosnia-Herzegovina. And essentially, the United States was funding al-Qaeda. And the al-Qaeda was integrated into the Bosnian Muslim army. Then you had Kosovo, and you had al-Qaeda operatives in Kosovo, which were collaborating with the Kosovo Liberation Army. And so these were insurgents which were supported and funded by the Western Military Alliance. In some cases, that funding was overt. The case of the KLA, well, they funded the KLA. This was a patriotic movement. They didn't look at the fact that actually al-Qaeda was linked to the KLA and also involved in training operations. And so what has happened is that in all of these wars, the United States has used these al-Qaeda-affiliated entities as their foot soldiers, so that in a sense we're in a very sort of ambivalent sort of duality. On the one hand, the U.S. says we're going after the bad guys, the terrorists, but then as far as covert operations are concerned, what they're doing is that they're actually recruiting these bad guys, mercenaries. They have a large-scale process of recruitment, always, of course, entrusting their allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, to do the dirty work. But in effect, I recall when I started doing research on Syria that in the spring of 2011, it was confirmed, and it was confirmed by Israeli intelligence sources that NATO and the U.S. and the Turkish High Command were involved in recruiting Mujahideen to fight the war in Syria. And the various factions within Syria, whether it's al-Nusra or the Islamic State and various others, they're all supported covertly by the Western Military Alliance, with certain allies playing central roles, such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey. There's a sense of denial in that regard. And one's understanding of the war in Syria, which is presented to the broader public, is that Bashar al-Assad is a dictator. He's killing his own people with chemical weapons. He's destroying the whole country, destroying factories, schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth, when in fact much of this destruction comes from U.S., NATO, Israeli-sponsored so-called jihadists trained in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, financed with weapons provided by Western military advisors, training in chemical weapons, which was even confirmed by CNN reports. And then what happens is that these people at the beginning of the war in Syria, they were labeled freedom fighters. Okay, they were part of the so-called opposition, so that in effect all the atrocities committed were blamed on Bashar al-Assad, when they were in fact committed by terrorists, which were financed by the Western Military Alliance. Mm-hmm. And as things progressed, the justifications started to shift, to the extent that since last August, the United States has now joined the war on terrorism within Syria by air raids, which are allegedly targeting the terrorists, but in fact, all the reports confirm that they're not targeting the terrorists. I mean, the terrorists could have been eliminated. They were there with their Toyota trucks crossing the desert. It would have been a clinical operation, surgical bombing, and it, in a few hours they would have eliminated them. No, they're protecting them. And those, that war on terrorism launched in August of last year, that means routine bombings of a sovereign country, they're not there to liberate anybody, or they're not there to go after the terrorists. They're there to bomb a country into and transform that country into a territory. And then what we have is, of course, this creates a refugee crisis. It destroys a national identity, not to mention the bombing of historical monuments and buildings such as Palmyra. And all this is done under the auspices of a humanitarian mandate of protecting civilians against terrorists, when in fact most of the people who are being killed are not the terrorists, but they're civilians.
Professor Chostodovsky, I'm wondering if, like, the game plan, like, did we know way back, did the neocon, the planners know, but way back in 1990 or whenever, that we're going to go into Syria in 15 years' time, we're going to go into Ukraine after that? I mean, or are these things that they kind of came up with as they went along, maybe in an ad hoc kind of way?
I would suspect, but from what I've read and the statements made, is that we're talking about a roadmap of military operations. The project for the new American century says, actually, that what is envisaged is the implementation of simultaneous theater wars in different parts of the world. Some of them, of course, are consecutive, but we now see, in fact, the United States deploy major regions of the world. And in terms of military deployment, regime change, colored, so on. So that, yes, I don't think, knowing how military planning is conducted, none of this is not a piecemeal operation.
Okay.
It is a carefully planned roadmap. And the thing is that when you look at the military actors, let's say Israel or NATO, Saudi Arabia, it's all coordinated. There's an integration of air defense systems. The allies work in very close contact with the Pentagon and NATO. And there is the plans, let's say, to invade Iraq. They go back to the 90s. The plans to invade Iraq and Iran go back to the 90s, according to U.S. documents. And I would say that active plans to bomb Iran have been on the drawing board of the Pentagon for at least 10 years. And so we're dealing with a formidable force, with all the logistics and high tech of communications, weapon systems, and that's where we are. The previous dogma was anti-communism during the Cold War era, and then there was a transition period, but people believe in the war on terrorism. They believe in 9/11. And at the same time, politicians in high office are in a very difficult situation, because if this belief starts to shake somewhat or is no longer as strong as what they'd like it to be, well, then the whole thing collapses like a deck of cards. They need the narrative. They need the propaganda. And that's going to be very important on 9/11, of course. They'll have to commemorate. They'll have to say we have the bad guys, ISIS, Osama bin Laden. And the irony is that if you The irony and the falsehood is that just about a week ago, General Porteous, who was former CIA boss and as well as Central Command general at one point in his career, recommended and to the U.S. government, the Obama government, to use al-Qaeda against ISIS. And that seems to be the new normal. So we support the al-Qaeda, the moderate al-Qaeda, against ISIS, who are the bad guys. But how can you do that when al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11? Are we saying now that the architects of 9/11, the presumed architects of 9/11, I'm not saying that they were, but the presumed architects of 9/11, according to the official narrative, are now allies of the United States against the bad guys of the ISIS. It becomes totally absurd when, in fact, ISIS and al-Qaeda is the same thing. It's al-Qaeda against al-Qaeda. And so to make us believe all this nonsense, they need more than simply media disinformation. They need a kind of conditioning of people's mindset that you can't go against the American Inquisition.
Okay. I have another. I want to, because we only have a few minutes left. But the whole idea that that 9/11 has also enabled a change in the international international institutions, certain restrictions on the kind of behavior that these nations can conduct. I mean, they invoked NATO Chapter 5 to go after terrorists when they haven't even determined that these terrorists they weren't directed by Afghanistan, as you pointed out, but somehow that loosened it up. It's also changed the kinds of doctrines, like the nuclear doctrine. It opened up the opportunity to use more powerful weapons, which they couldn't do before, did it not?
Well, the nuclear issue is a case in point, because shortly after 9/11, the Pentagon redefined its nuclear doctrine in relation to what it was during the Cold War era, that it was the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. You don't use it, because if you use it, your adversary will also use it, and this will destroy the whole world. That was understood. But now what they're saying is that there's a new generation of nuclear bombs, and we need those nuclear bombs to go after terrorists and regimes like Saddam Hussein, and they're called the small nuclear bombs. And then they come up with the notion that these nuclear bombs, which have an explosive capacity of one-third to six times the Hiroshima bomb, are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, I quote, unquote, and therefore we can use them. And then they also say we can use these to go after al-Qaeda. And then subsequently in the discourse they say we have to be very careful of the possession of nuclear weapons by non-state actors, intimating that the jihadists could also develop their nuclear bombs and could use them against the free world, so to speak, or the Western world, so that now there's been a big surge in attempting to prevent al-Qaeda from getting nuclear weapons, when, of course, the whole thing is ridiculous because al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset. But that's used as a means, essentially, for the United States to establish some kind of monopoly of nuclear warheads, which could be used, of course, but they now are contemplating the use of nuclear weapons in the conventional war theater, and there's nothing that prevents them from doing it. The Senate has given the green light, and it is no longer a matter for the commander-in-chief, namely the President of the United States, to give that green light. It can be taken at the level, let's say, of Central Command. So we're in a very dangerous crossroads in our history, because the dogma and the propaganda don't even allow you to understand the logic, the geopolitics behind all this, and the ultimate objective, which is the neoconservative objective of worldwide economic conquest, which is part, which is supported by the global war on terrorism.
I have one more question I'd like to direct to you, and it regards the whole 9/11 legend. I mean, you said earlier you destroy the lie of 9/11 and the whole the edifice of the war on terrorism falls down like a deck of cards. But we're hearing now that the new enemy is ISIS and that Al-Qaeda, as you were just saying, is now somehow the allies of ISIS. I don't hear anyone saying that ISIS was responsible for 9/11. So I'm wondering if the 9/11 legend is still needed to support the current war agenda. If 9/11 legend hasn't somehow worn out its welcome, and that even you could see that ISIS, I mean, people who aren't really well informed might see ISIS as blowback from the so-called bogus war on terrorism. I mean, I know somebody who believes that the Twin Towers are brought down by controlled demolition, but he still hesitantly is a supporter of the war on ISIS. Is that something you think you could address?
Well, you know, the whole thing becomes absurd because
I know, but
nobody remembers the fact that ISIS was in fact Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was it was its original acronym, and it is an Al-Qaeda entity, and consequently, from let's say the propaganda point of view, Al-Qaeda in Iraq or ISIS, which was renamed, should constitute the same threat as the other Al-Qaedas. But you're right in saying that the fact that ISIS has now got a new identity, which is distinct from Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden is presumably dead. So that they're building, as they proceed, they're building new narratives to justify military action, which are not necessarily hinging on the 9/11 attacks. The 9/11 attacks is landmark because it really is the launch pad of the global war on terrorism. But now you call these, you change the names, and then you might at one point have Russian terrorists, you know, because of course the U.S. Is also targeting Russia and also targeting China, so that they have to create an enemy, and they have to create the image of an enemy, and that image is there, and people see it, and they see it in Hollywood, and of course, the justification of which is provided by 9/11 may in fact fade, precisely because 9/11 truth is coming to a point where where a lot of contradictions are being revealed. But I should mention another thing: the 9/11 truth movement is not a homogeneous movement by any means. And some of these broader geopolitical implications are not well understood, so that they look at it from a purely domestic point of view. I mean, they've done fabulous work, but the broader implications are that 9/11 was the justification for waging war. There were other objectives. There were financial objectives and so on. But the key element in 9/11 is to justify the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and so that we have a sort of impetus to this long war, which the Pentagon describes essentially as a timeline, as a roadmap. And we recall the famous statement of General Wesley Clark when he said, when he confirmed from Pentagon sources that they were going to implement five countries in the list of seven, I don't recall correctly, would be the object of U.S. military interventions over a certain number of years. And that is certainly the case. If we look at the Middle East and Central Asia today, we have how many countries do we have at war, which are part now of the regional war? Pakistan, the drone war, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and then we have Yemen. Okay? Then we have a situation then we have Libya, 2011. Then we have the Arab Spring in other countries, regime change. Then we have actions by NATO and the U.S. military in Eastern Europe on Russia's doorstep. Then we have the pivot to Asia, which is threatening China. So, and if we look further south to sub-Saharan Africa, we have a number of wars which are presented as civil wars, but in most cases they are covertly supported by foreign powers.
Professor Chostovsky, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing that analysis with us on this rather critical anniversary. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization and the award-winning author of several books, including his most recent, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity.